Good morning. The Prison Population Task Force will come to order. We have an exciting agenda here for us today. We're going to talk about drug sentencing laws in Minnesota. I want to remind members that when we're done with the meeting, please keep your folders. It makes it a lot easier on staff. So we don't have to collect everything and redistribute it. You can keep your notes for meeting to meeting as well, so that'll be most helpful. We're going to aim to be concluded by noon today. I think we can accomplish that given the nature of the agenda. But I want to also remind members that your questions and your input is quite welcome throughout the process here. So don't be shy if you want some more information or want to flesh out something that's presented. We'd like to have that information brought forth for all of us to think about. So with that said, we're going to invite Nate Reitz to come forward from Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. He's going to give us a presentation on drug sentencing. Mr. Reitz.
Good morning, Chairman Latz. Good morning, Chairman Cornish. Good morning, members of the task force. I've been asked to present on an overview of drugs in prison in Minnesota. I will be, the focus of my remarks will be on the class of drug crimes that implicate prison the most, so we won't be talking much about the lower level drug crimes. We talked somewhat about how the lower level drug crimes impact prison beds at the last presentation, and those slides are appended to the slideshow that I'm the slide deck that I'm about to present at the end. Those are with one numerical correction. Those are the same as the slides that we presented in the October meeting. But I don't intend, unless there are questions on those, I don't intend to go over those at this time. Also, I've provided for the commission a memorandum that lists some questions that I understood some task force members to be interested in at the last commission meeting, and we've provided our attempt to answer those questions. Not all questions are answered, frankly, because we don't have answers for some of those questions. But to the extent we had answers to them, they are in your materials as well. I don't intend to go over those unless unless task force members have specific questions on those. I'd like to begin by describing the scope of the drug problem in Minnesota, which is admittedly beyond my scope of expertise, so I will just defer to other authorities on this. It is reported that last year over 52,000 Minnesotans were admitted for substance abuse treatment in the state. The pie chart on the screen shows the distribution of substances for which folks were admitted. These are not all illegal substances. You'll notice that alcohol and another drug comprise nearly half of the substances in question. And prescription substances also share a significant part. The numbers here obviously dwarf the numbers that are involved in the criminal justice system, and certainly the numbers that are involved in the prison system. A marker of the significance of the problem is the national rise in drug overdose deaths. This chart shows the rise from 1999 to 2013. A couple of comments on that. One is you see that the prescription pain relievers and tranquilizers make up the majority of drugs for which there are drug overdose deaths, and these are obviously legal drugs under the correct circumstances. The other is to note that heroin, particularly recently, has been taking up a greater share of the percentage of cases that are involved in drug overdose deaths. And these are national numbers, not Minnesota numbers. This next slide is also a national number pertaining to arrest rates for drug possession versus sale. This is from the Bureau of Justice Statistics. The upper line is the possession arrest rate per 100,000 people and in the United States, and the lower line is the sale arrest rate. Interestingly, it looks like the sale arrest rate peaked in 1989 and has been what I think could be described as on a gradual downslope since then on a per capita basis. And the possession arrest rate has not followed that same pattern. A national sentencing reform advocacy group called the Sentencing Project, citing Bureau of Justice Statistics data claims that there has been a 13-fold rise in drug imprisonment over 33 years nationally. The bar chart on the left shows 1980 versus 2013 in state prisons in the United States. The middle shows percentage-wise a very significant increase in federal prisons, although there have been some reforms that have been implemented since 2013 in the federal prison population with respect to drug sentencing, and also an increase in U.S. jails in the United States, which is not something I plan to spend any time talking about with respect to jails. This chart is similar to a chart that Commissioner Roy showed you in our September meeting. This deals with the Department of Corrections prison population and looks at different offense types as classified by the Department of Corrections. And the bottom row is the drug offense type. You see that from the beginning of the time that the data is on the website, which was 1998, until the most recent data, which was the July 1st, 2015 count, there has been a 171% increase in the percentage of drug crime prisoners. The that is the largest percentage increase of the categories that existed in 1998, and it's larger than the overall increase of 84% in the prison population from 1998 to 2015. Now, to take the time period of 1998 to 2005, the drug crime prisoner population tripled between that period of time, and 2005 was the peak year for the prison population for drug offenses. You can see, though, that we are climbing back up. Right now we're at we're below that 2005 level, but we are climbing. I'm going to be talking about meth in the next slide, and I think there might be some generally, and I'm not at the next slide yet, but the 2005 was, I think, what I've been told was the height of the meth boom during that period of time. And what I think is significant is how large meth is as a problem right now in terms of prison population. And I should say one last note on this this slide is that this is not per capita. This is raw numbers. So I should tell you that between 1998 and 2014, the population of Minnesota grew by an estimated 15.5%. So the so for example, the 6% increase in property crime prisoners didn't even keep up with the population growth. But certainly the overall prison growth and the drug crime prison growth greatly exceeded the population growth during that period of time. This slide I think is an interesting slide to me. It takes 2014 sentencing data. Now I should say that 2014 sentencing data is somewhat limited, but I selected a limited amount of data for the purpose of emphasizing what could be a serious trend here with respect to methamphetamine. This chart on the left looks at the drug crime prison beds, which is to say we take the sentences that were executed in 2013 and we multiply those by two-thirds, which is not going to be a precise measure of prison beds, but it is what we have data for, and I think it is somewhat helpful. The looking at that data in terms of 2014 sentences, we see that 65% of the prison beds are connected with methamphetamine, either with possession, which is the red bar, the red portion of the bar on the left, or with sale, which is the orange portion of the bar red portion of the bar on the right, orange portion of the bar on the left is sale. The 65%.
We have a question here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could just get some clarification, you have methamphetamines and amphetamine together. There are many amphetamine-based prescription drugs today, and so would the illegal possession of prescription drugs that you were not prescribed that have an amphetamine base be in under the meth and amphetamines, or would it be under a prescription drug section, or where would I find those? Do you know?
Mr. Reitz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, that is correct. This, okay, so on Minnesota criminal complaints, there are a variety of codes that are entered on the criminal complaints. And we take the coded data and analyze that data. So our results are only as precise as the codes. The codes group together amphetamines as one category. Amphetamines includes Adderall. Amphetamines includes meth. So it is a broad category. Our research suggests, and I think experience suggests, that the vast majority of these cases are meth. But I can't break it down any farther. We probably could look at 2011 data, since in 2011 we actually looked at each individual criminal complaint and not just the codes that were on those criminal complaints. But by comparison, in 2012, which is just 2 years earlier than this chart, meth accounted for, or the amphetamines category accounted for just 53% of prison beds. So it's gone up in 2 years from 53% of prison beds to 65% of prison beds. Whether this is a long-term trend, I have no idea, but it's something that could be viewed as a red flag. So on the right side of this, we have the race of the occupants of those drug crime prison beds as sentenced in 2014. So we're taking the bars that are on the left and asking the question, what is the racial composition of the group of offenders that went to prison by the length of time that they went to prison? So in other words, what is the race of the occupants of those prison beds?
Can you raise that up a little bit?
Sure, I'll zoom out here. There are three bars on this chart that don't correspond to the left side, and that's the top bar. The top bar is just the Minnesota adult population according to the 2010 census. So this shows what the racial composition of the state of Minnesota is. And that orange bar on the left is the white population. The key shows what the colors are. So it's white, black, American Indian, Hispanic, Asian, and other. And we don't have any other on our breakdown because that's not a category that we are given in our data from the courts. The bottom two bars show the total of all drug beds. So this is our calculation of all of the other. It's essentially a sum of all the beds combined, and what the racial profile of the prisoners by prison beds was as sent to prison in 2014. And I should say this, if I didn't already, that this doesn't include probation violation revocations. This doesn't account for the fact that there's credit for time served. It doesn't account for the fact that some folks, especially in drug cases, get out early on, for example, the challenge incarceration program. But I think it nevertheless is a useful measure, especially in the larger numbers at the top. As we start getting down toward the bottom, as you see, there are very few drug cases as a percentage here, very few drug crime prison beds. So I think that the racial composition gets a little less useful as you get farther down. But looking at the first line here, the meth line, you see that the racial composition of meth crime prison beds is... And that does include amphetamines, but mostly meth is our understanding. It's significantly white, and in fact, it's the category that most mirrors the total population of Minnesota as a whole. And the same is true with the black population. It most closely mirrors the population of Minnesota as a whole. When you look at cocaine and heroin, those are flipped. The white population is significantly smaller than the black population for those two drugs. And again, as you start getting farther down, the population sample sizes get smaller. For the rest of the presentation, we're going to be focusing on sentencing in first and second degree drug cases and what are the sentencing practices that are employed right now. We didn't reprint the sentencing guidelines for you, but if you'll recall, or if you still have the sentencing guideline grid from last time, you'll note that first and second degree offenses are ranked at severity level 9 and 8 respectively, which are both presumptive prison. In all cases, the Guidelines Commission treats first and second degree offenses very seriously, as seriously as a number of significant prison crimes, and the prison sentences are in accord with that. The pie chart here shows that a third of the prison beds as sentenced from 2012 to 14 are went to first degree offenders, and a third of the prison beds went to second degree offenders, and the last third was distributed between third, fourth, and fifth degree offenders. So first and second degree also end up being those offenses that take up the most prison beds, so that's the primary reason we study them. So even though presumptive prison is true in all of these cases, fewer than half of the first and second-degree drug offenders get that presumptive sentence. The pie chart shows first-degree offenders on the left, second-degree drug sentences on the right. The yellow slice of the pie shows those offenders who got the presumptive sentence, 34% for first-degree, 45% for second-degree. Now, there are two types of departures that these offenders can get. One is a mitigated dispositional departure. That's the dark brown. That means that even though the guidelines called for prison, the offender got a non-prison sanction, which could include up to a year of jail. It could include probation, treatment, that sort of thing. And then the lighter brown on the bottom, that means that the offender got an executed sentence, but it wasn't for as long as the guidelines presumed it should have been. The reasons for these departures vary. The most common ones are listed on the left, most common being that the offender accepts responsibility or shows remorse. That would be typically something you might find with a guilty plea. These multiple reasons can be cited. An offender might be, offenders are frequently considered to be amenable to treatment or probation or rehabilitation, and that's a commonly cited reason as well. The prosecutor's position on departure is shown on the right. That is not necessarily a reason for departure legally, but it certainly influences the situation. Those classes where those cases where either the prosecutor did not object or the prosecutor affirmatively agreed with it or recommended a departure or where it was part of the plea agreement, those are all grouped in the large slice of the pie, the 61% of these first and second degree cases where there was a mitigated departure. In 18% of the cases, the prosecutor objected to the departure, and in 21% of the cases, we don't know that the departure worksheet did not reflect what the prosecutor's position was.
And Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Reitz, in the fifth degree area, are you able to tell me how many people are offered a 152.18 in the fifth degree controlled substance on a yearly basis and then actually successfully complete that, meaning that they are basically you get a fifth degree controlled substance crime and related to possession, and then after a year, I mean, it's a disposition from a felony to a misdemeanor, right? And then, so I think what's important, I'm curious about the numbers there because, you know, you don't get a fifth degree controlled substance crime and automatically go to prison. I think that, I mean, the world needs to understand that pretty clearly as well, too, right?
Mr. Reitz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen, three comments. One is, the data that we're showing here, and for most of the rest of the slide, just have to do with first and second degree, so we're not talking about first and fifth degree. So all these folks presumably should go to prison as the guidelines are currently.
No, I understand that. I'm sorry. It was yep. Trying to, you were moving along pretty quick, and I didn't. You had a good flow going, and I'm sorry. I wanted to get back to just showing the numbers on the fifth degree because it makes up a piece of the pie. And when you're talking about whatever our numbers are, again, commissioners, for totals, I mean, 14% is still a significant number of beds.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schoen, and I would, I think there's a little more light on the fifth degrees in those drug cohorts that I presented last time. It does talk about, it looks like a significant number of those fifth degrees are people actually asking to go to prison for whatever reason, whether it's in connection with another case or they've just done so much time that they really don't have much more time to do, or they're just sick of their probation officer or whatever the case may be. None of these are, well, actually, that's another category of possible going to prison and it being a, sometimes people get a 15218, which actually isn't a misdemeanor, it's a deferred prosecution. So it's no conviction at all, unless it is, unless the judge says, all right, we're revoking your 15218. And sometimes we see where the judge repeatedly, tolerates a number of violations and finally says, that's enough, you're going to prison. Well, that's a departure. Even though it looks like a probation revocation, it's not a probation revocation. The initial sentence in that case is, because they go from no conviction to conviction, sentence, prison, all in one day, sometimes. And that is a departure from the sentencing guidelines, because the guidelines would presume, unless you have a very high criminal history, the guidelines presume a stayed prison sentence in those cases. So those can be some departures. But in terms of the data, we do not collect that. Our native data does not show 15218 dispositions. Our native data, the point where the legislature has installed us on the criminal justice road, is the point where somebody has been convicted of a felony offense and is being sentenced for that felony offense. Initially, so we don't see the 15218s unless they are revoked, and we don't necessarily always know that they are revoked. It is possible that we might be able to dig up some data on 15218s, but we would go to the courts. So I would refer you, Representative Schoen, to the courts.
Commissioner Roy,
Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen, we did some research on that. Prison bed impact of fifth degree, and it's about 525 beds, and that was primarily the probation revocations.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At some point, because we're talking about whether or not we should be making changes to the first and the second degree drug sentencing, are we going to actually talk about how much drugs you have to have in order to get to first and second degree? Because it's different based on the drug amounts, based on the drug, and I think that it's important for folks to understand that whether we have a little bit or whether we have a lot as we're making these decisions.
Representative Hillstrom, on the item 4 on the agenda, we'll be considering Senate File 773, which does recommend some changes in thresholds.
So we'll be talking then about what doses those are, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hilsum, I believe that Judge Wernick will also be covering that. And the last four or five slides in my presentation compare our sentencing practices to other states, which does get into thresholds a little bit, at least for those scenarios that we show in those slides. So we're looking at departures and what causes variance in the departures. The slide entitled Departure Rates Vary by Race shows that there is some variation in the departure rate by race. There's also some variation in the departure rate by judicial district. And I think there might be some correlation between those two in terms of the racial distribution in this state is not uniform across judicial districts. And there are different sentencing practices in judicial districts. So I think that does account for some variation by race. We in fact researched this using 2011 drug offense data on first and second degree cases to see if we could figure out what were the significant effects on mitigated departures. Our race finding did not find any significant effects for any of the racial categories except one, and that was the offenders who were Hispanic were 64% less likely to get a mitigated departure than offenders who were white. That was the only statistically significant effect for race or ethnicity. And it has been suggested that there may be some factors that we did not consider that may account for that, such as immigration status or perceived immigration status, but we don't have data on that, so it isn't possible for us to study that. The second significant effect that we found was on judicial district. We found, looking at 2011 data, so this is not necessarily current, that compared to the 10th district, which was sort of the average district in the state at that time, offenders sentenced in the 3rd and 8th judicial districts, which are southeast and western Minnesota, respectively, were less likely to get departures, whereas offenders in the 4th judicial district, which is Hennepin County, were twice as likely to get departures. We also found, not surprisingly, that criminal history was a significant effect on whether or not an offender got a mitigated departure. Offenders with a criminal history score of 1 or more were 65% less likely to get a departure than an offender who didn't have a criminal history. And an offender with a drug weight involved that was twice the threshold amount, that is the amount to get to that level of crime or more, were 38% less likely to get a departure than an offender who had closer to the threshold amount. Some of the possible reasons why judges might be departing in some of these cases, other than the reasons shown on the previous slides, have to do with some findings that we found that probationers and ex-prisoners, going to prison doesn't necessarily mean you're going to do better in terms of public safety. So a judge looking at public safety could rationally conclude, I think this data could say, that probation may not be something that would harm public safety. We found in this study that probationers had a new conviction rate of 21%, whereas ex-prisoners had a new conviction rate of 27% in the 3 years that we followed these offenders after they were released from prison or placed on probation in the period of 2007 to 2009. This slide does not have to do with Minnesota sentencing or first or second degree controlled substance sentencing, but this could have to do with durational departures potentially in terms of judicial decisions to depart durationally. This is a federal study where they happened to make a policy change, and they made it retroactive, that a judge could reduce a lengthy prison term for somebody who had gone to federal prison for crack. And they found that the group that was given a break in their sentence, that's called the retroactivity group on the left, they got an average of a 22-month drop in their prison sentence, which was a 20% reduction. Doing the math, you can see that these were pretty long sentences that they were originally sentenced to. They found that the recidivism rate for that group was really comparable to the group where there was no sentence reduction and they served out the full length of the term, even though, according to the study, there wasn't any difference in the two groups in terms of their risk factors. So that could have to do with durational departures.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as I look at these two graphs, it actually appears that those who retroactively had a reduction in sentence actually reoffended less than those who did not. Am I reading that correctly?
Mr. Rutz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, that's what the pie charts are showing here. The way that the study was framed was that the retroactive reductions did not affect recidivism. So I assume that the writers of the study saw the 52 and 57% and said they were close enough that You know, we can't necessarily say you're better off with a lower sentence, but it doesn't appear that there's an increase in public safety with the reduction in sentence. Mr. Chair, I'm concluding my presentation with these four slides that talk about presumptive sentences in comparable guideline states. We've selected four other jurisdictions, three states and the federal, that have fairly similar guideline systems to the state of Minnesota. They're mature systems. They've been around for a while. I believe they all have some appellate review of judicial sentences that are outside the guidelines and so forth. And so what we're doing here is we're taking four typical first-degree sale, possession, second-degree sale, possession offenders based on our 2011 data and looking at what somebody who would be a typical Minnesota offender for first and second-degree sale and possession would get in each of these five different jurisdictions, including Minnesota. So the first profile here of a typical first-degree sale offender from 2011 data is... And this is 10 or more grams of cocaine, heroin, or meth in a 90-day period is a first-degree offense. There are other ways to get to the first-degree offense, but that's by far the largest. The offense sentenced here would be a first-degree sale. This would be a white or Hispanic male in his early 30s, sentenced in the metro area with a criminal history score of zero. The drug would be cocaine or meth. We chose cocaine for our example. As you'll see, that does make a difference in some states, particularly Kansas, whether it's cocaine or meth. Less than 20 grams. The act was a confidential, reliable informant was used. There was an actual sale, and the offender was convicted of a first-time drug offense. As far as aggravating factors, there was no gun or children present. And in fact, notwithstanding the guidelines, this offender most likely was sentenced to probation in Minnesota. So in our example on the right column, we're taking a sale of 19 grams of cocaine, no weapon involved, criminal history score zero, first-time offense. In Minnesota, the presumptive sentence for a severity level 9 offense, which is a first-degree offense, is 86 months in prison. In Kansas, that would be 49 months in prison. Washington, it would be 16 months in prison. Oregon, 16 to 18 months in prison. And federal, there would be a range of 10 to 16 months in prison. Example number two, this is possession, first-degree possession. So the threshold is higher for that because it's only possession, not sale or possession with intent to sell. 25 or more grams of cocaine, heroin, or meth. The scenario here for each state is possessing 49 grams of cocaine, no weapon involved, criminal history score of zero again for this particular fellow, and first-time drug offense. In Minnesota, the presumption would be the same, 86 months. Kansas, it would be presumptive probation for possession, 11 months. Washington also would be jail, 3 months. Oregon, 90 to 180 days of jail, and federal, no prison. So the sale or possession distinction is pretty important in these other jurisdictions. And I should say that most of these jurisdictions do have possession with intent to sell equated with sale, just as Minnesota does. So we're assuming that there's no intent to sell here, that the offender was just possessing the 49 grams of cocaine without intent to sell, or at least the state could not prove intent to sell. So here's our example. The next slide is our sample second-degree sale. This offender has a criminal history score of 0 or 1, and it's less than 10 grams of meth. The cutoff here is 3 grams for second-degree sale. Again, no aggravating factors present here. The example that we're using is a sale of 9 grams of meth, no weapon involved, criminal history score of 1, first-time drug offense. Minnesota is prison for 58 months rather than 48 months because of that criminal history score of 1. Now, Kansas has a low threshold for meth sale and a high sentence for meth sale relative to Minnesota. Meth and heroin both. It's 3.5 grams, and their prison term would be 104 months. So this is the one point on the on this presentation where another jurisdiction has a more significant, well, this and Kansas on the next slide, too. Washington has a 16-month prison term presumed. Oregon has a non-prison probation sentence of 90 to 180 days jail and 3 years of supervision. And the federal has a prison range of 15 to 21 months. Although for possession, typically our understanding is that the federal prosecutors don't tend to take those cases. I'm sorry, this is a sale, but I should have said that for the last possession case. With respect to the second degree possession, again, we're using a criminal history score of 1. Same, this is example 4 now, same prison term, 58 months in Minnesota. Same prison term in Kansas, because there's a rebuttable presumption in Kansas, and I'm not aware of any rebuttable presumptions in criminal law in Minnesota, but there's a rebuttable presumption in Kansas that if you have 3.5 grams of meth, you're intending to sell that. So if the offender was able to rebut the presumption, then he'd be looking at a significantly lower prison term. But if the offender was not able to rebut the presumption that he was possessing the 24 grams of meth in our example here with intent to sell, then he'd be looking at prison for 104 months in Kansas. Washington would be jail, 16 months, and Oregon would be 90 to 180 days of jail. And there wouldn't be any prison required in federal, although, as I said, federal would be unlikely to take them. Mr. Chair, subject to your questions, that concludes my presentation.
Senator Deeser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize if I missed this, but why did you pick Kansas, Washington, and Oregon to kind of compare, use these comparisons?
These are, thank you, Mr. Chair. The factors that we used to select these jurisdictions were, first of all, they have a permanent sentencing commission. Parole discretion has been abolished in these jurisdictions. They have a fully developed, mature guidelines system. The guidelines, at least originally, were not advisory, although some of these are advisory now after the Blakely decision a few years ago. And the guidelines are enforced by appeals. So those are the basis for which we selected these jurisdictions, Mr. Chair and Senator Dietzig.
Do you have a follow-up?
No, it's just another comment. Representative
Cornyn. Mr. Reitz, as closely as you can, give us a clear description of your organization's authority. I've been hearing all sorts of rumors lately that the Sentencing Guidelines Commission can put certain things into effect, and then they would stand as rule unless the legislature, what do you say, de-ratified them or by legislation prohibited that. What can and you can't do with either thresholds or sentencing lengths and terms?
Mr. Rutz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, Chair Cornish, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission does have the authority to modify the guidelines. If the commission decides that it is appropriate to modify the sentencing guidelines, that goes before a public hearing, before final action is taken by the commission. So there's a, first of all, there has to be a decision by the commission to put it to a public hearing, and then there's a public hearing, and then after the public hearing, the commission debates and determines whether or not the change to the guidelines is warranted. And most changes to the guidelines, there's an additional step where the it has to be presented to the legislature by January 15th, and then it does not take effect until August 1st, unless the legislature by law provides otherwise. So the legislature essentially has an opportunity to veto any decisions that the commission chooses to make. So, but the commission does have the authority to change the sentencing guidelines.
Sure.
Representative Cornish.
So the January 15th you're talking about is that mandatory or is it an option for your organization? So in other words, if you didn't meet that deadline or present that, you wouldn't be able to enact the guidelines?
Mr. Rice.
Mr. Chair, that is correct for the vast majority of types of changes. There are some minor changes that do not implicate legislative overview under the statute, but for most significant changes, if not all significant changes, there is a January 15th deadline. So if the commission missed the January 15th deadline, that would mean that it wouldn't take effect until August 1st of the following year. Again, there has to be an entire legislative session intervening the commission's decision, the commission's final decision, and implementation of the change.
I'm really trying to nail this down as to our authority and your authority. So the presentation that you would have to make to the legislature, could that be done in paperwork and presented in a report, or would you have to appear? And if the legislature was fearful of what was coming, could they just not give you a hearing and prohibit you from having that hearing and therefore destroy the process?
Mr. Rice.
Mr. Chair, that's not how the statute is currently written. It has to be included. Typically, it's included in the report to the legislature, which is a written document that is also due on January 15th that we are required to submit. And that there's nothing in law that requires a hearing before the legislature. Obviously, the legislature is free to conduct a hearing.
So, Mr. Chair, if the legislature was fearful you were going to give away the farm and let everybody go and didn't want that to happen, then the only way it looks like they would be able to circumvent that process would be by taking action during session and prohibiting it. In other words, if you produce a report and deliver us to it by the deadline, you've satisfied the statutory requirements, and it would force the legislature into, if they didn't agree with it, to take action during a session before August 1st, then. Correct?
Or not? Mr. Chair, Chair Cornish, yes, that's that is true. I will say that the 11 members or 10 sitting members, as one is vacant, each represents a stakeholder group, and each member of the commission listens to that stakeholder group and listens to the legislature. So certainly the commission is susceptible to persuasion by the stakeholder groups they represent, and I think that is the normal mode I think that's what the statute contemplates, is that the commission members would be persuaded as to what the best policy is by the groups that they represent.
And a final question.
As you like, Representative.
We would, the question I had is, do you integrate and cooperate with the Department of Corrections and the Commissioner Roy? Because there's been a lot of questions where we've asked you for stats, where Commissioner Roy jumps in and gives us the stats, where it didn't seem you have them. Do you have them or ability to get them? Or do you network with the Department of Corrections? Because some of these, you know, Commissioner Roy has volunteered information it didn't seem like you have. Do you have access to the same information? Can you get it if you need it?
Mr. Rice.
Mr. Chair, I think one of the things I'm looking at it as Executive Director is attempting to better integrate our data with court data on the one end and corrections data on the other. I will say that right now we have really good control over, again, a particular checkpoint on the criminal justice highway, which is the point at which somebody is sentenced for a felony. We are weak on looking at the data for probation revocations, for supervised release revocations, for, there's a number of, which, you know, all that feeds into the population that Commissioner Roy has. So when he's looking at his fifth-degree offenders, you know, our cohort chart looks at fifth-degree offenders, but it only looks at as they were initially sentenced. So this is the first cohort here that I'm showing on the slide in your appendix. This is the cohort that's sentenced for more than 1 or less than 2 years, and most of those are fifth-degree offenders. 401 offenders in that category. But what we don't know is, you know, how many other fifth-degree offenders were originally put on probation, then revoked, and sent to prison. Commissioner Roy has that data because he has to. They come to him, and he knows why they come to him. If we were better integrated with the courts, I think we could have a better handle on some of that data, and if we were better integrated with DOC. We're working on that, but we're not there yet.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
To that point specifically, Commissioner Roy.
To that point specifically, Mr. Chair, we do have a close collegial relationship with the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and as a member of that commission, I share information at those meetings as well. Our research department also works closely with guidelines staff in prison projection estimates, and the reports that you folks get about our quarterly projections are worked with an algorithm that is executed both with our staff and guideline staff.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I was wondering, as a result of Representative Cornish's questions, which is about your authority, but what would initiate an action or consideration of changing the guidelines for you? What are you studying or looking at that causes you as a group to take up the probability of changing a guideline? Is it initiated by an inquiry from one of the stakeholder groups, an idea from one of those groups, or are you tracking outcomes in a way that causes you to make consideration of change? What stimulates that discussion in that making changes in the guidelines?
Mr. Rutz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sharon, I would say all of the above. We are constantly looking at the data. We're looking at sentencing practices. The commission, from their varied experiences, the commission members bring issues before the commission. Sometimes the legislature directs that the commission look at things or examine things. So it's a constant process of making sure that the guidelines are doing what they're set out to do, that they're meeting the statutorily established objectives for the sentencing guidelines in Minnesota.
All right, Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Reitz, we have slides showing comparisons of the different jurisdictions, the different states, and how they treat crimes and given certain scenarios. I was wondering if you have any data also with regard to different jurisdictions in terms of how they deal with the correctional system and recidivism, the efficacy of the sentence itself. Is there any data that we can implicitly know that diversion programs or dealing with people with first-time offenders in a different way, whether it's rehabilitation or treatment, is more effective, or is it more important to not just slap people on the fingers and to actually be a little harsher with first-time offenders? Do we have any longitudinal data that suggests that one approach to reducing recidivism is better than another?
Mr. Reitz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hershaw, I think that's a really good question. We would probably need additional resources to be able to really do an interstate study on all of those factors. There is some research going on right now in, for example, the Rubina Institute, which I don't see Kelly Mitchell here right now. I know the Rubina Institute is doing interstate research. Pew Charitable Trusts is doing research along those lines. So there certainly are a number of important groups that are doing the type of research that you're describing?
I think Commissioner Roy might have an answer. Commissioner Roy?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we, as part of our mission, have to reduce recidivism, and related to that, we have done robust research around the efficacy of chemical dependency treatment, and also various probation agencies around the state have done similar studies that we have published, and we can certainly get to you. It looks like about a 20 to 25% reduction in recidivism for completed treatment inside, and community treatment has similar results.
Your Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is actually to Commissioner Roy. Commissioner Roy, we were given a slide that fewer than half of the first and second degree drug offenders get the presumptive sentence. Are you able to take that data and then tell us of those that did not get a departure and did not go to prison, how many of those then went to boot camp and actually didn't serve the sentence that they were actually given, so that we actually have a clear picture of how many folks are actually serving the presumptive guideline sentence and how many are not serving the presumptive guideline sentence? And then if we could get that broken down by race as well, which is on the next, the departure rates by race, if we have those that actually serve, then how many then go to boot camp and don't do the 48 months or 86 months, but actually do 18.
As the result of their participation in CIP?
Correct. If we could get that.
Yes.
Not today, but.
We do have that information, and that is one area that we are very interested in because it is a significant part of our programming, and we have done two studies on that, actually.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that it's really important that we see that data, because if one of the goals is to reduce the prison population problem, if you're already diverting a large number of this population, you want to make sure that you're actually doing a solution that will actually solve your problem, and not coming up with a solution that you've actually come up with a different solution for by sending them to boot camp.
We always look for solutions that work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Senator Latt, this question is for, I actually have a couple questions for Mr. Ritz Race. Going back to the population, the slide where it tripled from 98 to 2005, at 171% increase in possession, looks like, trying to read this with the light here, with possession charges in prison. Of that increase, because of some court decisions that were made to dealing with possession of stolen property and in some burglary cases and the jam-ups in the courts, with how many of those, that percentage was just pled guilty, if you know, just pled guilty to possession charge and did not end up pleading guilty or getting charged with the property crime? And would that be the decrease in the property crime issue and the increase in possession charge? Because I know in all the search warrants I've done, the vast majority doing a search warrant in a burglary case, a theft case, we always find drugs. And it's easier to get through the court system with the plea on the drug possession than the possession charge for the stolen property. When you get that information, if it's just the possession charge for the for the drugs, with this information put together, do you know what percentage of them had other charges that were dropped because of the plea agreement?
Mr. Rutz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do not have that information. Those categories are assigned to them by the Department of Corrections, and it's my understanding that it's the characterization of the most serious offense that they're serving time for is what controls the designation. So they could be in there for multiple offenses. It would be the most serious one that controls.
Representative Johnson.
So they pled guilty to the possession charge, and just so they did not have the burglary or the possession of stolen property charge. So It was actually a victim crime that they did, but because of the possession charge, it freed up the court time, and we got that person off the street that was doing 80 to 100 burglaries, but the easiest way to get them off the street was just take the possession charge and free up the court time.
Well, Representative Johnson, it might not only have been the easiest, but it might also have been the most serious crime. And so it's quite common in court that a prosecutor will offer a plea to count one, the most serious crime, which is the way they charge out typically the complaints, and in return will dismiss counts two and three, which would be less serious offenses.
I would say that possession of a narcotic is a much less than if anybody's here has had a burglary in their house.
No,
that is much more serious. But they're pleading out to the possession charge, so because it's very difficult to prove a burglary. It's very difficult to prove possession of stolen property with some of the court rulings that have come out.
Well, the seriousness of the crime is typically defined by the maximum sentence allowed under the statute. So if the legislature's made a decision that the possession of the narcotics is a more serious crime because it's, say, a 10-year felony, where the burglary that's being charged is maybe a 5-year felony, then that's a decision that the legislature has made in creating the statutory maximum sentence that's allowed. Certainly that question is open for changed by any legislature that wishes to do so.
Mr. Chair?
I didn't see, but I had one other question. Mr. Wright.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to respond. Point. Also, I think to corroborate what Mr. Chair is saying, burglary is in most cases less serious than a first or second degree controlled substance crime, as that is ranked by the sentencing guidelines and consistent with the statutory maximums for those offenses. That may not be your feeling if you are a victim of a home invasion, but that's what the law and the guidelines currently say.
Professor Levy-Pump.
I have a couple questions for Commissioner Wood and a quick question for Ms. Lewis. What percentage of people who need drug treatment actually receive it within the Department of Corrections?
Mr. Chair,
Commissioner Roy.
About 35%.
So only 35% of those who need drug treatment currently receive it.
That's correct. Even since we are the largest treatment center as a department in the state, it's sad to say we don't treat as many as we should.
So I guess the reason for my question is you're here asking the legislature for $140 million in bondage buck money for 500 more beds, and you just said that
drug treatment will result in a 20% reduction in
recidivism.
So why
wouldn't the focus be on more money
to adequately
fund treatment programs so that you wouldn't need as many prison beds?
Mr. Chair, actually, we have been talking about the need for additional treatment beds since I've been here, and our approach to this prison problem involves expanded treatment as well. But we have a crisis right now, and that's why our bonding proposal has been put forward.
Professor Levy-Pump.
So my next question, excuse me, I'm looking at the chart related to sentencing in first and second degree drug cases. I think it's around the bottom of page 4. And there's a graph here that shows roughly 16% of prison bed sentences are for fourth and fifth degree drug-related offenses. Has any research been done to identify whether incarceration is the most effective way of addressing such low-level drug offenses? Because we're talking about over 1,000 people, right, who are incarcerated for fourth and fifth degree drug offenses. So I just want to know, has any research been done to make sure that this is the best place for the lowest level of drug offenders? That's 1,000 beds right there, plus.
Commissioner Rush.
If I can discern the question about the best return on investment, whether prison or treatment, would that be a fair summary of your question? Has the most efficacy and for success. There is a lot of research, and the community corrections folks, especially, and American Probation and Parole Association, and most professional organizations that have done that research would show that a shorter incarceration period coupled with treatment while incarcerated and treatment that continues in the community has the best results, if in fact there is incarceration needed. And that varies, of course, from court to court and from county to county.
So there is research that talks about whether incarceration is appropriate for a particular group of.
Well, the appropriateness, I think, is a question that research wouldn't necessarily reflect, and that certainly is a political decision that has and a justice issue generally. But research would show the efficacy of different treatment modalities and how they relate to incarceration. And our research department could provide you with that.
And then I just have one last question.
Professor Levy-Pons.
For Mr. Reese, is diversity a value of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission?
Mr. Wright.
Mr. Chair, Professor, I do have an answer in part to your last question, if I could.
Sure.
First. So the judicial branch has been doing quite a bit of work on this. They've, in cooperation with the legislature, have implemented a drug court program in a number of counties throughout the state, which do emphasize treatment over imprisonment. There was a 2012 statewide evaluation of the drug court program, which did find that after 2.5 years, drug court participants had a 37% recidivism reduction versus a non-participating comparison group, and that a number of most of the participants, a number of community functioning measures were likely to improve, but. That is something that I think the judicial branch could testify more knowledgeably than myself on that. But there's, I think, a correlation between those types of programs and that kind of research and the departure rates that we're seeing for drug cases.
Professor.
So has the Sentencing Guidelines Commission made recommendations that are consistent with the research that you just articulated in terms of a shift in how we treat fourth and fifth degree drug offenders?
Mr. Chair, Professor, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission did this year acknowledge what has been essentially a fact in judicial practice for some time, which is that a particular amenability to probation, and particularly a particular amenability to treatment, has been a basis for departure for a while. That was not enumerated in the guidelines because, and this sort of gets into one of your other questions, there was, I think, a fear, at least the comments seem to reflect it, that if you start looking at somebody's particular amenability to probation, you might be looking at social and economic factors that might cause there to be discrimination introduced into the system. If a person who's not in poverty has a more stable social situation than a person who is in poverty, is that person more likely to get probation than not? So I think that is one reason why the guidelines stayed away from articulating particular amenability to probation for so long. There certainly are cautionary statements in the commentary to the guidelines. As far as lower level offenders, the guidelines do not presume that the fifth degree offenders get probation unless they have a very long criminal history. So I'm sorry, they do not presume that they get prison. The presumptive sentence for the fifth degree offenders is in most cases probation, and I would refer you to the cohort analysis that talks about those fifth degree offenders going to prison because they are demanding execution for whatever reason. Or as far as whether the commission values diversity, I will say that the commission's enabling statute requires the governor to consider maybe diversity isn't the word that's used in the statute, but it certainly requires the governor to consider diversity type issues in appointing members to the commission, and the commission has always maintained that sentencing should be neutral with respect to race and sex. So I mean that's certainly racial considerations have always been in the forefront of the commission's mind in creating sentencing guidelines. And in fact, one of the reasons for the creation of the guidelines was to ensure that there was a reduction in sentencing disparity throughout the state. The commission staff has in recent years prepared for the legislature racial impact statements that alert the legislature to potential crime proposals that might exacerbate the existing racial disparity in either the prison population or the felony offender population, which the legislature is free to consider as they wish, but that is a service that we provide to the legislature at this time.
Chair, Professor Levy Pound.
Are there any people of color currently serving on the Sentencing Guidelines Commission?
Mr. Chair, Professor, we have I believe we have one person of color in the 10 members who are presently appointed. There is a vacant position that the governor that it has been vacant for some period of time, and although I cannot speak for the governor's office, I can tell you that in yesterday's announcement where the governor solicited applicants for various positions on boards, I think there were 300 vacancies on various boards throughout the state. One of those vacancies was the probation officer position on the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. And in the governor's announcement, it indicated that diversity was a goal of the governor's office. I'm not a spokesman for the governor's office, but it may be that is the governor's intention to enhance the diversity of the commission in making that particular appointment.
Senator Dziesek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could we get a copy of this either emailed to us or posted online? I've had a request, so if we could get this for staff to post online, that would be appreciative.
Any other questions for Mr. Wrights and Sentencing Guidelines Commission before we move on? Thank you, Mr. Wrights.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
You can retake your chair as a member of the task force here, and we'll welcome to the desk there Senior Judge Mark Wernick, retired Hennepin County judge and also a commissioner of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission for some information on drug sentencing. Welcome, Judge.
Welcome. Thank you for having me, Senator Latz, Representative Cornish, and members of the task force. I did prepare a PowerPoint. I know how to do PowerPoints, but I don't know how to present them. And so Mr. Wrights is going to sit next to me and help me make sure I get through these slides okay. But this is my PowerPoint and not his. By way of background, I began my legal career in 1975 as an assistant Hennepin County public defender. I did that for 2 years, and in 2007, I went into private practice, and I'm sorry, in 1977 to 2002, I was in private practice, practicing almost exclusively in the area of criminal defense in both state court and federal court. In 2002, I was appointed to the Hennepin County bench by Governor Ventura. In 2014, I retired from the bench. I'm now a senior judge status. I can still hear cases. And earlier this year, Governor Dayton appointed me to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. I am one of three public members. I am not one of the judicial branch members. I'm going to be talking about, and I should say I'm here in my individual capacity. I don't represent the Fourth District Court, and I don't represent the Guidelines Commission. I'm here as someone who's been in the criminal justice system for 40 years. I'm going to be talking about the evolution of our first through third degree controlled substance crimes, specifically with respect to cocaine, heroin, and methamphetamine, because those are the drugs that most often land people in prison. The guidelines in Minnesota came into effect in 1980. From 1980 to 1986, Chapter 152 made it a crime to sell or possess with intent to sell drugs, and they were the same thing. Both were considered the same offense. These were considered relatively nonviolent crimes back in the early to mid 80s. There was a willing seller and a willing buyer, and they did a transaction. And the guidelines had this raked either at the low level or the mid level, depending on the drug. And the sentences for a first offender were presumptively probation, or getting on later in the 80s, you might see presumptive 24 months imprisonment. In 1987, the federal sentencing guidelines went into effect, and that's where we saw on a national scale that drug amounts became a proxy for an offender's position in the drug distribution hierarchy. And the higher you were up in the hierarchy, the more serious the offense and the longer the punishment. In 1989, Minnesota followed suit. That's when the legislature enacted its current five-degree structure, where again drug amounts became a proxy for an offender's position in the drug distribution hierarchy. First degree controlled substance offense was a crime designed to capture the major wholesaler. There were two crimes, two ways you could be found guilty of a first degree crime. One is possession, where the state had to prove possession of 500 grams or a half a kilo. The state did not have to prove intent to sell, and basically the theory was, and if you have that much cocaine, meth, or heroin, you have the intent to sell, and we're not going to make the state go ahead and prove that independently. Or you could be prosecuted for sale in the first degree level, and the quantity there was 50 grams, but sale at that time meant only the distribution. It did not include possession with intent to sell. The rationale was, if you find somebody who has, in effect, an inventory of 500 grams, they are likely to be selling in 50-gram or multi-ounce quantities, and that's the person we're going to call the major wholesaler. And the guidelines at that time were 81 to 91 months for a person having a zero criminal history score. That's a commitment to the Commission of Corrections. At that time, the guidelines in federal court for 500 grams, and I'm comparing apples to apples here, 500 grams in Minnesota, possession where intent to sell is presumed, 500 grams federal where it's possession with intent to sell has to be proven. But for someone with the inventory of 500 grams under the federal guidelines, it was roughly comparable to Minnesota guidelines, 63 to 78 months for cocaine, 78 to 97 months for heroin and methamphetamine. A couple more points about the federal sentencing guidelines. In Minnesota, as you know, you get a 33% discount off your prison sentence for good time. In federal court, it's only a 15% discount, so you have to keep that in mind when you're comparing the numbers. Second, in Minnesota, this 500-gram threshold described the top. That was the, it didn't go higher than 500 grams. So it was 500 grams or more. Under the federal guidelines, they keep going up and up and up. And you can get up to a 30-year life imprisonment sentence in federal court if the amounts are high enough. But still, comparing 500 grams with 500 grams, the state and federal guidelines were roughly comparable. Second degree offense back in 1989 described what's called a mid-level wholesaler. There you could get a conviction for a second-degree offense if you proved that the defendant had an inventory of 50 grams. If you had an inventory of 50 grams, the intent to sell would be presumed. Or you actually sold 10 grams. Again, the rationale was you're describing somebody selling in 10-gram quantities, and that was considered the mid-level dealer, the mid-level wholesaler. Under our guidelines at that time, it was 44 to 52 months. The federal guidelines for cocaine were 21 to 27 months, so a little less than ours, 33 to 41 months for heroin and meth, so again, roughly comparable. Next, we had our third degree. Third degree defined our low-level dealer. If the defendant had possessed 10 grams, there was a presumption of intent to sell smaller amounts, or if it was prosecuted on a sale theory, it could be a sale for any amount. Both under the possession or sale theories, the rationale is that we're describing an offender who is selling small quantities. That could be a low-level wholesaler, somebody selling 3.5-gram quantities. That person who buys the 3.5 grams may be selling off in gram quantities, or it could be someone just selling off in gram quantities. So it's either a retailer or a low-level wholesaler. 21-month stay probation was the presumptive sentence in Minnesota. Under the United States guidelines at that time for 10 grams, it was 10 to 16 months for cocaine. I have the asterisk there by the 16 is because in federal court at a 10 to 16-month level, you could serve up to half the time in a local facility. You wouldn't have to serve at all in prison. Also, if you were to plead guilty, you could get a reduction of 2 levels. It would be 6 to 12 months, and you could do that all in local confinement. So the guidelines were 21 to 27 for heroin and meth, so a little bit heavier on the U.S. guidelines, but in general, I'd say roughly comparable. So if
Judge,
we go...
We have
yes,
a question for
yes.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. So there was no distinction on the drug. So whether it was cocaine, heroin, meth, amphetamines, marijuana, it was all treated the same based on your slides. Is that correct?
Judge Warner.
Yes. And Senator Latz and Representative Hillstrom. In 1989, I believe methamphetamine, heroin, and cocaine still had a separate statutory designation, and then other narcotic drugs were in separate parts of the statutes. But I believe in 1989, the quantity thresholds were typically the same for all narcotic drugs. It changed, though, as I'm going to explain in just a few minutes.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Go ahead, John.
All right. The next event here, pardon? Okay, and Mr. Wright is telling me maybe marijuana was treated differently. Okay, so next we have 1991 in the case of State versus Russell. In 1987, the distinction first arose in Minnesota statutes between crack cocaine and powder cocaine. And that distinction made it into the 1989 statute. So before, for example, on first degree, I was describing the 500-gram threshold. If it was crack cocaine, the possession threshold was only 25. So possession of 25 or sale of 10 was punished the exact same way as possession of 500 and sale of 50. In 1988, the year after the Minnesota legislature first made the crack cocaine, powder cocaine distinction, 97% of the crack defendants were black, and 80% of the powder cocaine defendants were white, and I got that data right from the State versus Russell opinion. And so the Russell Court held, it was affirming, and many of you know this case, Judge Alexander's decision in Hennepin County District Court, that the crack powder cocaine distinction violated our state equal protection clause. This was a, well, you either loved this decision or you hated it, I guess, is the way it goes. But it was unusual in that the court was not going to require the defense to prove that it was the state's purpose to discriminate against black people. It was enough for the defense to show that it had a disparate impact. And once that showing was made, the court put a heavy burden on the state to justify that disparate impact. And the court said that the state could not justify the disparate impact. Everyone assumed after that decision that crack was essentially eliminated from the statute, that all cocaine, be it powder or crack, was going to be judged by the 500-gram, 50-gram quantity thresholds. But lo and behold, the legislature surprised us. And what they did was they did two things. And before I say that, I have on the slide dictum. In the dictum means that it's language not necessary to reach a decision. But in the opinion, the court was troubled by this mandatory presumption of intent to sell, and they thought that might be unconstitutional, but they didn't say it was. So two things happened after Russell. The quantity thresholds for cocaine, heroin, and methamphetamine were reduced to the crack level. And sell was changed to include possession with intent to sell. With these two changes, you no longer had a structure where quantity thresholds were used to describe a major wholesaler, a mid-level wholesaler, and a low-level dealer. That structure was thrown out the window, and the following slides will show you how. All right. Now, for a first-degree offense, it's possession of 25 grams with intent to sell presumed, or possession of 10 grams where the state could, if they could prove intent to sell, that was also a level one. Before you had to actually sell 10 grams or 50 grams, now it's you only have to possess 10 with intent to sell, and then the 500 number went down to 25. The effect was that an offender with a 10-gram inventory selling smaller amounts, which, if you recall, had been a third-degree presumptive probation offense before Russell. Now, if you have a 10-gram inventory and you're selling smaller amounts, you're a first-degree drug dealer under Minnesota statutes. The only difference is that, yes?
A question for you. Professor yes. Levy Pumps.
So Just to quantify this, 10 grams is roughly two teaspoons of crack cocaine, right?
Well, I don't know how to actually. I think I'm thinking of powder now, and 10 grams is a. Well, if you just think of an ounce of sugar, an ounce is going to cover the bottom of a little baggie, and 10 grams is about a third of an ounce, and so it's not a very big size.
Right, so right. Just to do some level setting so that people understand, for certain drugs, we're talking about a very low-level quantity that could heighten your status as now a first-degree offender.
Right.
Because you don't have to prove that it was possession for personal use.
Well, you have to prove if it's in order to get a first-degree penalty, possessing 10 grams, the state has to prove intent to sell, not all 10, even one, but your possession has the intent to sell. That used to be a third-degree crime before Russell. Now it's a first-degree crime after Russell.
You know, maybe at some point, not today, clearly, but we could get, not with the actual drugs, of course, but use sugar as a proxy. We could get a demonstration. Someone could bring in an actual physical amount to show us what the weights would look like so we can visualize.
Okay.
Might be helpful.
Sure.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually was going to say maybe we could get the BCA or someone from law enforcement to actually bring it in so we could see 10 grams equals how many doses of cocaine, heroin, or meth. Because to me, even a teaspoon doesn't tell me how much of that you need to get a high. So I want to know if 10 grams is getting one person high, five people high, 500 people high. I just don't have a concept of that number of doses.
We'll ask the BCA to help us out at some point. Representative Constantine.
Mr. Chair, the Hennepin County Drug Task Force used to have a rather impressive demonstration and brought in a lot of stuff for training purposes. I've been retired for 5 years, but I'm assuming they still have it.
And if I could add, does this speak to the potency, so how many times something's been stepped on and things of that nature? Because that's a key component of this as well, because 25 grams of something that's been stepped on five times is very different than 20 something that's 95% pure.
The statute doesn't distinguish in potency, does it?
No. The statute, it outlaws a mixture that contains whatever drug we're talking about, and at the 10-gram level, you're probably getting something that's stepped on quite a bit. But
this was an issue in a decision that Representative Kahn carried a bill a few years ago to remedy, where there was a water, I think, in a water pipe that had some marijuana residue in it.
It was methamphetamine. It was bong water.
Bong water, and because it had a tiny, tiny, tiny bit of residue in it, it was considered a mixture. By the courts and
I think the legislature actually
they measured
straightened
the quantity of the water that was in there, you know, not the quantity of the actual drug itself. Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, I remember some of the discussions going back a number of years now, but the weight itself is not necessarily as important as the intensity of the drug or what the complexity of the drug was. Methamphetamine was a product that had to be created at that time. It was mostly created in a bathtub back at home somewhere. And that created a little bit more enhancement for that purpose of making it. And if you're making it, you can't make it in little gram amounts. You have to make it in large amounts. And so that was a consideration. And also, as was said, the potency or the intensity of the drug also was considered in addition to just the weight. If we just focus on weight and see a little powdery residue in a baggie, you might make that decision falsely if you were not considering the intensity of the drug that was being created or sold.
Senator Latz and Senator Limmer, your point is a good one, and there are people urging drug reform to give more attention to the purity of the substance that's being prosecuted. But for now, we don't do that. We're continuing to use drug amounts or mixture amounts as a proxy for the chain of distribution, and essentially the point I'll be making in this presentation is that when these amounts got changed, the chain of distribution notion just went out the window, and we can see it here on the first degree. Now, possession of 10 grams with intent to sell, and that 10 grams might get a lot of people high for a couple hours, but it's still the lowest level dealer you got. It's the street dealer. And that person, under the guidelines, no criminal history score, is presumed to get a 74 to 103-month sentence. Now here's where we start to vary from the federal guidelines after this change. For cocaine in the federal guidelines, possession with intent to sell 10 grams is 10 to 16 months. Heroin is 15 to 21 months. Methamphetamine, 21 to 27 months. So now our guidelines are much more severe than the federal guidelines. We can go to second degree now. This was supposed to be the mid-level wholesaler. It used to be 50 grams or 10. 50 grams possession, 10 sale. Now it's 6 grams with intent to sell presumed, or 3 grams if you possess 3 grams. If you were that 3-gram buyer from the 10-gram inventory, you're now a mid-level wholesaler under this framework, but you're really not. You're a low-level dealer. So the effect, again, is to take a street dealer pre-Russell, and now we're calling that person, same person, a mid-level wholesaler. Guidelines are 41 to 57 months. If you have possession with intent to sell 3 grams under the federal guidelines, you're looking at 10 to 16 months, or if you plead guilty, 6 to 12 months for cocaine, heroin, and methamphetamine. So what used to be 500 possession with intent to sell, first degree went down to 10, and what used to be 50 went down to 3 for second degree. If we go to post-Russell third degree, there's really no significant change there. It's still 21-month stay for the low-level dealer, the lowest-level dealer, roughly comparable to the federal guidelines. My last slide is a chart, and it shows what happened with each degree, pre-Russell, post-Russell. And if you take a look at the pre-Russell third degree, it's a 10-gram inventory intending to sell smaller quantities. That crime is now a first degree. And if you look at the third degree, that's now embodied in the second degree. So we have this whole notion of major wholesaler, mid-level wholesaler simply don't apply anymore. The statute applies basically to the small-time dealers. First degree certainly would include the big-time dealers, but we're punishing the small dealers like we would the big dealers under our current guidelines, and that, in my opinion, helps explain why there are such high departure rates for first and second degree drug crimes.
All right, and then this summary graph on the end is helpful to put it all on one page.
Yes.
Thank you. Are there any further questions for Judge Wernick? Judge, Professor Levy-Pump.
I just have one more question about whether conspiracy charges played a role. I know in the federal system, conspiracy charges can take someone who's a low-level dealer up to kingpin range simply because of who they're associated with.
So you don't see many conspiracy counts in state court complaints. You do see aiding and abetting counts when they're charging more than one person, very close to conspiracy, and aiding and abetting under the statute would include conspiring with. So yes, if you have a if a major dealer wants to pass along 500 grams from point A to point B and pay someone $100 to do it, that person who took the $100 is going to be responsible for that full amount. State doesn't have to prove you know what the amount is either. It's just whatever the amount is there. Now, that defendant who's just the runner is certainly going to ask the judge for a downward departure for having a minor role in the offense, but the statute doesn't distinguish between the two. It's based on quantity.
Representative Schoen.
Mr. Chair and Your Honor, that's a kind of a good point. The aid and abet versus conspiracy. So when you talk about it in federal realm and the state court, I mean, most cases that build up conspiracy to that level, when you're talking about the kingpin level, actually are a pretty intense and ongoing investigation, and you're pinning down that person who typically tends to be in the hierarchy of a criminal organization. And that is where most of those are used, in my experience, versus the aid and abet where they maybe got in a car and helped drive it somewhere or helped arrange transportation and got caught up in that. I think, do we see that in those cases don't tend to stay in state court in those realms. Do you see that as your experience too, or would that be accurate?
Judge Warren.
Senator Latz and Representative Schoen, you will see where I said we used to stop at the 500 gram. Now we stop at the 10 or 25 gram, very small. But you're right. When it goes to the big levels, where the guidelines are quite severe, we're not going to see those levels. Those are going to stay in federal court. So I've been comparing comparable amounts. So if that answers your question. Mm-hmm. So, but in the federal government has the same problem. There might be a shipload of or a plane load of cocaine landing in Oklahoma somewhere, and you got some guy out there that's supposed to, you know, make sure the pilot gets to the right phone, and that guy's going to be responsible for a plane load of cocaine.
Mm-hmm. And usually that's the U.S. Attorney's Office is just making discretionary decisions on what levels they're going to use their resources to prosecute. Right. And below certain levels, they won't deal with it. They'll let the county attorneys handle those prosecutions.
And Senator Latz, if I could say, I've used the federal guidelines as a comparison because when we were making, in 1989, rational distinctions between major, mid-level, low-level based on quantities, we were in line with the federal government. I mean, and so we fell out of line. That doesn't mean we should copy them. I mean, there's very big differences in the cases they prosecute and the cases that we see in state court. But it was a good guide at one time.
Mr. Ward.
Mr. Chair, members, outstate Minnesota, though, you are seeing more conspiracy charges being charged out in the complaints, and not on huge amounts. And Judge Warnock and I know each other from me being in Hennepin County as well, so I don't want to generalize what happens in the metro area and not seeing conspiracy charges. We are seeing that in greater Minnesota, and not on these huge kingpins. We're seeing it on relatively small amounts of methamphetamine cases and some heroin cases as well.
Mr. Chair? Representative Hillstrom.
Go ahead
on the follow-up on that. Representative Schoen.
Yeah, Mr. Ward, do you find that being in connection to... I mean, we know that we have some relation to whether how, say, a girlfriend or boyfriend may be tied up when they're not actually the number one contributor, but because of a relationship and that emotional connection. Do you see that as part of that charge? Is that where you're seeing some of that? Or do you have any instances? I mean, I guess it seems like we're trying to provide insight, and I know we're coming to another presentation coming up next, because the question I would keep asking, but I know it's coming up, is a bill with some suggestions, but I would go around and, so then what's your suggestion? So, but what is the person or their crime look like, or what are you seeing that mostly related to?
Mr. Ward.
The hows and the whos, I guess.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, it's very broad. Ultimately, as you know, it's prosecution discretion as to how they're going to charge out the case. If there are boyfriends or girlfriends that are involved or just friendships involved, it depends on the resources and the investigation, how long they've been watching, how many people that they believe they can charge or round up in any particular, whether it's small-level distribution or large-level. So it really depends, and it's very hard to come to any generalization as to particular charging. But, again, in the last year I've been in this position, I've seen more conspiracy charges in greater Minnesota than I've ever seen, and I never saw them in Hennepin County.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about your slideshow presentation. So I've been comparing the grams that you have in your slideshow from 1989 for first degree for the major wholesaler as well as the second and third degree. So basically, the Minnesota statute, we actually kept those same grams under hallucinogens, amphetamines, and like LSD, but we went to the lower grams for cocaine, heroin, and meth. And then we kept, we have a different amount for marijuana. Is that correct?
Yes, but the quantity thresholds changed after Russell, only for cocaine, methamphetamine, and heroin. But the definition of cell changed for everything. And so where you used to have to show, for other narcotic drugs, you used to have to show a 500 inventory for a possession with intent to sell theory. By changing the definition of cell, you now only had to show a 50-gram inventory.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So now that I'm looking at the hallucinogen amphetamines, we see a lot of the amphetamines and meth. This is why I asked the question about methamphetamine, amphetamine, because like Adderall is an amphetamine. So under the first degree, for the hallucinogen, amphetamine, and like your LSD, you'd still have to have 50 grams for sale, and that equals, or 200 doses. So you'd be selling 200 doses of amphetamines, hallucinogens, or have the intent to sell. For the possession, the 500 grams is the equivalent of 500 doses, according to the statute. And then it goes on the same. So really the section that majorly changed post-Russell is the cocaine, heroin, and meth. That's correct. And then the change in the definition of sell. I'm just trying to get scaling what your presentation is.
I believe factually what you've said is correct, but I would disagree with the characterization of major change because, for example, for narcotic drugs and amphetamine or hallucinogens, you could get, it was 500, but actual sale of 50. Now it became possession with intent to sell 50, so the inventories went way, way down. That's a big change.
All right. Okay. Mr. Chair, one last question about the change. Thank you. So currently, for a first-degree sale of marijuana, it's 110 pounds of possession with the intent to sell, 110 pounds of marijuana for first degree. Did that change post-Russell at all, or do you know, has that been the same?
I'm looking at my materials that I've submitted to the commission. So pre-Russell on marijuana, it was 100 kilograms or actually selling 50 kilograms pre-Russell. Post-Russell, possession with intent to sell 50. So it could be sale of much smaller amounts than 50.
So, okay, so it's sale is, I just am not good at the metric system, so I have, so it's 110 pounds in the first degree.
That's more, 100 kilogram, 1 kilogram is 2.2 pounds, so
right.
100 kilograms is 100. Whatever, 220 pounds.
Okay, all right. That was just the clarification that I needed to get as we're talking about weights and doses. It's important, I think, for us to understand the weights and doses. If we're talking about making changes, we need to understand the scalability of these drugs and whether we're talking about enough for a single use or for the whole high school class. I mean, that's all, Mr. Chair.
Professor Levy-Ponce.
I would agree with that, and when I've heard Judge Alexander talk about the rest of the decision, the way that she described it is that rather than lowering the threshold for crack, the punishment became more harsh for those other drugs that you mentioned. And that doesn't necessarily mean that there was pharmacological evidence to support that change. It was more about perhaps leveling the playing field. So we need to know whether or not what we have in place right now makes sense in terms of all the research that's been done since the 1980s regarding the war on drugs and its impacts. The other part of this that I don't think we should take for granted is the ways in which conspiracy charges are being used because it plays a role in terms of the charging decisions being made by prosecutors and the plea bargaining that happens outside of the system that judges may not even be privy to. And so if you have someone who is a low-level dealer, but they're connected to a drug ring, and that drug ring is going to be charged with a large quantity, suddenly that person could be facing, I don't know, 10, 15 years for if they sold that same amount as an individual, maybe they're facing 5 or 10 years. And that could be, and because of the leverage of prosecutors, they could say if you go to trial, you're going to face 20 years. But if you agree to this amount, then you'll get 8 years, even if they really perhaps deserve 3. So that's an issue in the federal system that folks are revisiting, and I don't think we should take that for granted here because it may mean that we have folks who are charged as higher-level dealers or facing more time than they should because we're not paying attention to what happens outside the purview of the court.
Representative Considine.
My question, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's similar, I think, I'm guessing maybe Commissioner Roy might be the person to address it too, but Representative Schoen talked about girlfriends, boyfriends. So on these conspiracy things, they may not have any active participation other than their boyfriend told them to hold on to the stuff, And then when they refuse to testify against the boyfriend, they're getting the maximum sentence. How many people would you say we have that, is that a significant number of people in our prisons that are in there for relationships rather than any real drug crime?
Commissioner Roy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it would be difficult to quantify that relationship, but we certainly have women in Shakopee that are there because of a relationship with a drug-using partner.
And that would be a conspiracy charge then, or is it be the possession because they're actually holding it?
I can't answer that question.
Oh.
Representative Hills.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Considine. So you can get aid and abet the possession of drugs, but mere presence isn't enough. So you can't just be by someone who's in possession of it. You actually have to take some action. But if you're holding the drugs, no matter who owns them, you are guilty of possession of the drug. So, but just merely being present is not enough to be convicted in Minnesota.
But if your boyfriend said, hold this or else,
mm-hmm.
You're stuck with it.
Yeah.
Prison might be it. I want to move on because we have we'll have some other Mr. Wright's final comment, and then we'll move on the agenda.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of things on the conspiracy. My understanding is the big difference between drug conspiracy and other conspiracy is I think under normal conspiracy you get half the amount of the crime, and drug conspiracy you get the whole amount. But we at least haven't yet, Mr. Ward, we haven't seen a lot of conspiracy cases. I don't have a quantity for you, but that we don't see a lot of conspiracy cases or drug cases. If the thresholds were reduced, it is possible we might see more of those as sort of leverage tools. But right now it seems like based on the statutes, the way they're read, we don't see a lot of conspiracy or zone cases, which are those cases that are enhanced because of where the crime took place. The other thing I had was a question for Judge Warnick, which is, I know in 2014 the U.S. Sentencing Commission reduced the severity levels of drug crimes by two levels on the U.S. sentencing grid. When you were doing your comparison, were you using the reduced, the new levels, or were you using the pre-2014 levels?
When I was talking about, Senator Latz, when I was talking about the 1989 United States guidelines, I was using the 1989 guidelines, and when I'm talking about current U.S. guidelines, comparing them to current state guidelines, I was using the reduced guidelines. And there's just, that just reminds me, because I intended to mention this reduction. I said, for example, that on first degree, way off. If you were to get anywhere near a 74 to 103-month sentence under the new federal guidelines that have been reduced for two levels, instead of 10 grams in Minnesota, 10 grams possession with intent to sell, to get that kind of sentence in federal court, you need 3,500 grams of cocaine, 3.5 kilos. To get 74 to 103 months in federal court for heroin, Minnesota, you need 10 with intent to sell. Federal court, you need 700 with intent to sell. To get 74 to 103 months in Minnesota for methamphetamine, it's possession with 10 with intent to sell. Federal court, 350. Way off.
Commissioner Roy, final comment.
Mr. Chair, just in terms of reference, and if people are struggling with weights here, I'm holding a first-degree granola bar at 35 grams. So that is.
Deputy. All right. Thank you, Judge. We're going to invite Mark Levin to the desk now. Did I pronounce that correctly? Levin or Levine?
Yes, Chairman. Levin. Now you got Levin. Exactly right. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Levin is the policy director of Right on Crime. He joins us today from Texas. We really appreciate your coming to testify to us, sir.
Welcome your thoughts.
Well, thank you for having me. Thanks so much to all of you for your hard work on this and studying of these issues. And obviously, I feel a little weird coming from Texas to tell you about reducing the prison population, since we have a much higher incarceration rate than Minnesota, of course. But, you know, the trends, we've actually been doing better going down while you've been going up. But undoubtedly, our baselines are very much different, and we're, you know, have a lot of differences between Texas and Minnesota. But I do think you can learn some things from what's been done in Texas and many other states in recent years. And I think that clearly from the testimony that's already been given, the drug sentencing laws in Minnesota are not only out of whack with most other states, but also the federal laws, which are often used by state prosecutors to refer drug dealers to the federal prosecution, where they can get a tougher sentence at the federal level. And we've, in fact, been involved with a number of bills in Congress going on that would revise various federal drug sentencing laws. Let me just tell you a little bit about who we are. Texas Public Policy Foundation is a state-based free market think tank, and we actually have counterparts in all 50 states, including Minnesota. And I started our work back in 2005 looking at the criminal justice system in Texas and studying how we could reduce recidivism, cut crime, at the same time cut our prison population. And we started Right on Crime in 2010, which is our national campaign for criminal justice reform, with a statement of principles that's been signed by people like Newt Gingrich, Jeb Bush, former drug czar Bill Bennett, former Attorney General Ed Meese, and so forth. And so this certainly, we're not people who are soft on crime, but we want to be both tough and smart on crime. And I think that's the interest of everyone here as well. So let me just address several things. I think that, first of all, I will tell you that what we've seen over the last 5 years is the states that have reduced their prison populations have seen crime fall more than those that haven't. What's become clear is there's many ways to reduce crime, including policing advances and so forth, rather than just increasing the number of people in prison. Obviously, Minnesota's had an increase recently in the number of people in prisons, looking at potentially having to expand a prison facility and the additional costs that come with that. What's really encouraging, particularly when it comes to the drug issue, is not only can you save money, but there's approaches such as drug courts, the Y Hope Court, that actually get better results and reduce recidivism. I think as you look at trying to combat substance abuse in general, it's also good to consider that while the focus today is on drug crimes, many property crimes are committed by people seeking money for drugs. So to the extent you can reduce addiction as a whole, you could have a very positive impact. Now, one of the things is, I think that as you've heard today so far, for the same amounts, the drug sentences here are significantly higher, although judges have some discretion to depart. I think, you know, obviously you've seen that one of the things that I think is important to note is the sentencing is one piece of it, but in Minnesota, 60% of the people going to prison are revocations from probation or supervised release, and many of those are technical violations, which can include positive drug tests and so forth. I've been kind of hunting for data on that, and I heard earlier that, in fact, there isn't much data, which is exactly what I came to conclude in looking through various websites. So it's difficult to determine what percentage of revocations are for various things and how that varies across different counties, and we have some of the same data challenges in Texas. So I'm certainly sympathetic with that. But if you look at across the country, what you'll find is a lot of states have moved, and I'm sure this is being done in Minnesota to some degree, but towards graduated sanctions as well as incentives for people on probation. So, in fact, if somebody has a positive drug test or is missing appointments, they go to county jail for the weekend instead of, in many cases, waiting for these violations to pile up and then revoking someone to prison. So there's been a great deal of success in that, and a lot of states have looked at how can we send money back to the counties to do these graduated sanctions, send money to our probation department so the caseloads aren't too large so that you can't implement that. So that's certainly an area to look at. And in fact, the swift, certain, and commensurate sanction model is the Hawaii Hope Court, which has had a two-thirds reduction in substance abuse and violations and so forth. And so that's where, you know, you get a number, green, blue, red, a color, excuse me, at the beginning, and you call in every morning. If your color's up, you go in and take a drug test. If you fail, you're told in advance you're going to jail for the weekend. This is run by former federal prosecutor Judge Alm, and has had tremendous. Washington State now has converted their whole parole system to the HOPE model. So that, there's a lot to be gained by looking at things like that. One of the things that I think, as you consider the legislation and some of the proposals before you is certainly there's been a big move to get rid of mandatory minimums, and where that kind of crops in here with the drug laws is if it's a second or more conviction, we're looking at potentially 4 to 40 years, including a mandatory minimum of 4 years if it's one of the higher degree levels, but even down at the fourth and fifth, you're looking at, if you have a prior one, up to 30 years and at least 1 year, and then on the fifth degree, at least 6 months in jail and up to 10 years in prison. So getting rid of those, I think, is certainly a positive thing, and it's consistent with what a lot of other states have done as far as rolling back mandatory minimums, including in New York, rolling back the Rockefeller drug laws. One of the developments this year, Utah passed a major overhaul of their criminal justice system, and that included reducing penalties for low-level drug possession, the smallest amounts, to a misdemeanor. And I really want to point out that one of the things they did, which is also a positive aspect of the proposal to be discussed later today, is make sure you reinvest a lot of those savings into, particularly if you're cutting down to a misdemeanor, sending it back to the counties who are then going to be responsible for it. And they did do that in Utah, and I think that's very important, because one of the things is oftentimes the level of the charge, the amount that someone's found with, that doesn't necessarily correlate with what their need for treatment is or with what, you know, and so you can have someone, we have in Texas a number of trace cases where someone literally has less than, a scintilla, you can't even, it's so small you can't test it twice, and sometimes they're charged with paraphernalia. The issue is, if you make it too little, like a Class C misdemeanor, which is like a traffic ticket, then there's nothing to compel someone into treatment. And you can have someone with an extremely small amount, but is passed out, about to die of a drug overdose in front of some business. So there's a need to be able to compel people into treatment and to be able to, it may take several months. So if you have it too low where you can't keep someone long enough, then you can't really address the problem. And of course, in most states, the counties are responsible for misdemeanors, and so it's important as you do, and that's why I cite Utah as a model, because they made sure that they had a reinvestment component, and of course as a misdemeanor there, it's still punishable by up to a year in jail, so you have that year to get somebody into treatment as well and compel them to do so, because I think one of the problems we've seen in some states, for example, California a number of years ago passed a proposition, not the most recent one, but Proposition 36 over a decade ago, and they didn't have enough teeth in it to actually get people into treatment and make sure they completed it. So that's an important thing to consider. One of the other issues that did come up in the towards the end of that was the school zone law, and I do think that's something you should look at. So in Minnesota, if you do have one of these drug offenses within less than within 1,000 feet of a school, not only a school but park or public housing, it is enhanced to the next level, essentially. And so the concern, I think it's appropriate to have these types of laws, but they ought to hone in on if you're actually either dealing drugs to a minor, or you have an intent to do so, rather than somebody who's just driving by one of those areas within 1,000 feet gets pulled over for speeding, within 1,000 feet of a school, and now they're subject to this enhancement when their drug possession had nothing to do with minors or the school. So one of the things that that I wanted to also talk about is the probation system, and in particular, Minnesota is of course low in its incarceration rate compared to the national average, but relatively high in the number of people on probation, above the national average per capita. Of course, part of that is some people aren't going to prison, but also part of it is needing to look at your length of probation terms, increase your number of early terminations for people that are exemplary after 2 years. What you find is part of the challenge, and this goes back to what I was saying earlier with your technical revocations for probation, is you got over 100 people being watched by every probation officer. Now, if you get people off of probation who don't need to be on there anymore, you can concentrate the supervision resources. Also, divert some misdemeanors from probation altogether. Which has been recommended here before. So you can do those types of things and therefore have better supervision of the people that really need to be on probation. The data all shows if almost all the problems that people have on probation are within your first 2 years. If you haven't messed up within that time, you're probably not going to have any problems. Now, a number of states have adopted earned time policies for both probationers and, in fact, many inmates, particularly nonviolent offenders. And so you can have an earned time. I would recommend an earned time measure for people on probation. So by, we've adopted this in Texas, a number of other states, by completing a degree, getting an occupational certification, things like that, you earn a certain number of days off your probation term. And, of course, you can't have any violations. So it's a real positive incentive for people. So I recommend taking a look at that. One of the other things that's important to look at is the role of medication-assisted treatment. There have been a lot of success, particularly as it relates to opiates and heroin that's been exploding, but where people can get injections of certain medications that literally block the receptors in the brain that are activated by those opiates. Unfortunately, they're rather expensive, but they're covered to some degree by Medicaid and private insurance. With these injectables or something someone only has to take orally every 30 days or something, it's very easy to make sure that they're taking it, which is a compliance challenge. So those can be very effective. Obviously, you have to look at, you know, when you have someone who's even a dealer of a small amount, some of those people are dealing to support their own habit. So, again, you want the flexibility in your sensing laws to sort out, does this person need treatment? Are they dealing to support their own habit? Or, you know, obviously there's people that are just big-time drug kingpins. I think most of them are prosecuted on the federal level. But, you know, as was said earlier, when you went down from 500 grams to 50 grams or whatever on the first-degree felony, you started bringing people in who weren't necessarily kingpins. They're wholesalers, and that's where I think you've run into the challenges. One of the issues is the RAND Institute, which is, I think, a very credible source, but they did a study basically looking at whether locking up drug dealers for a long time really gets a lot of public safety benefit. And what they found was only for the very top-level kingpins do you get a real benefit. For the lower level people, they're interchangeable. They find somebody else to sell drugs on the street corner. And, you know, I don't take any joy in that. It's certainly not a good result. And it doesn't mean those people don't need to be punished. But if your goal is to say, how can we use every prison cell to maximize public safety, definitely murderers, rapists, people that are dangerous, and frankly, thankfully, there aren't many people who are inclined to commit those crimes, so those people aren't replaced, to be frank about it. So I would encourage you to look at a lot of those things. I really think that you're on the right path in many ways, and I think that as you look at it, you know, I was, I'll just conclude with this, but I had a chance a week ago to visit a drug treatment program in Iowa called St. Gregory, where people come around from around the country to be into this drug treatment program, but they also get a lot of referrals from the criminal justice system, and they do some really interesting things, including the medication-assisted treatment, but also they post bail for people out of charitable donations to bail people out of jail to get them immediately into treatment, and they also, interestingly enough, through charitable donations, they pay for people's first few months of premiums under the federal health care law, which are, you know, heavily subsidized. So maybe $150 a month, and you're getting an excellent health plan that covers your drug treatment and so forth. So, and again, they're using a lot of charitable donations for this. And they have a whole, wellness program, and they have people on IVs. They have a lot of different things going on to basically detox and get these drugs out of people's system. One of the challenges that they have is particularly people with co-occurring disorders who have a mental health problem as well. And one of the challenges is people come in with they're also on a lot of mental health medications, and oftentimes not complying with those two-thirds of the time, so they're taking them at varying levels. But all sorts of levels are going up and down in their body, and one of the things is for people sometimes with depression and anxiety, they can be over-medicated on mental health medications, and that can create problems with also when they're also on illegal drugs. So what they found success is at first getting, for those people that may not really need to be on those mental health medications, getting those tapered off, and then being able to work on the issue of obviously not being on illegal drugs and kind of, frankly, getting pleasure from the normal things that we do in everyday life. And I think a lot of people turn to illegal drugs to get these artificial highs, and it's complicated by the mental health problems. And so many people, I think, have such imbalances going on that you're not able to, until you're able to really clear those out in a controlled setting with this type of residential treatment, you're not able to address that. So, again, I appreciate the opportunity to share these thoughts and would be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Levin. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Director, is it Levin,
yes,
your last name? Thank you. That was an excellent presentation, but, boy, do you talk fast. So I didn't get it all in, but what I'd really, really like, if you have
perhaps
anything.
Perhaps we can get the presentation in writing if you have.
Yeah, I was going to ask for at least a.
at least a bulleted list of all your ideas here, because you had several that I thought were quite good. I know we like to, in Minnesota, sometimes pride ourselves on what excellent programs we have and so forth, and how. But there are times in different areas where we don't have those programs compared to other states. But what I wanted to commend Texas on particularly are the two programs that you have for people with mental illness and people with mental illness and chemical dependency for jail diversion. And San Antonio has a national example and has gotten different awards for their program in jail diversion for people with mental illness. Of course, that also translates into less people going into prison after jail if they have a mental illness. So that, and then Houston, I understand, also has a new program that is very promising and will be successful, and that San Antonio program has saved millions of dollars for the taxpayers, as well as making a much more sensible approach to those illnesses. So I just wanted to commend you on that and hope that we can at least follow your examples in those areas, because it seems to be working quite well.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, no, that's a very good program. So one of the things there in the San Antonio is if somebody's like yelling at the top of their lungs at McDonald's, they have these 24-hour crisis beds. They can bring those folks to, you get criminal trespassing, just people that, because of their mental illness, are doing these minor things. And one of the things they're doing in Houston is they've identified some of these frequent flyers. They're going to the county jail dozens of times a year who are mentally ill. They're driving by their home with a counselor, either a deputy or a probation officer, whatever, but a few times a week, making sure they're taking their medications and things, and they've really seen that reduce the jail cycling in and out. One of the things I forgot to mention earlier is the prescription drug laws, because I don't think we've touched on that in this hearing so far, but you can have a felony in Minnesota for abusing prescription drugs as well, and I would suggest taking a look at that. Obviously, if you're dealing in large amounts of prescription drugs, I think that could be appropriately a felony, but for the people who are, possessing them without a valid prescription, abusing, and this is, a big problem. Obviously, people are having surgery and things like that, getting addicted to these painkillers. Sometimes they're then moving towards heroin because it can be cheaper in some places, but in any case, I would suggest that it probably should be a misdemeanor for possessing illegal prescription drugs, but again, with some treatment and enough time behind it so that you can intervene with those people. One of the other things is the LEAD program in Seattle. I had an opportunity to go up and tour that. Now, that's a pretty radical approach, but they took an area downtown Seattle where there were a lot of homeless people disturbing the neighborhood in front of businesses and residences and things. And so they the deal there is if you it's for drug, small-time drug dealers, very small amounts, people dealing to support their own habit, plus prostitutes. But if they agreed to go through this assessment with a caseworker that the police bring them to physically instead of bringing them to jail, they are not prosecuted for that. And the recidivism study came out. It's had a great deal of success. They also have emergency housing for these people. So I was up there with a delegation from Texas, and our district attorney down in Houston, it was a bridge too far for her, but she did come back and implement it with regard to just marijuana possession. So now the way that started is if you have the smallest amount of marijuana, nothing significant on your prior record and so forth, you're brought to the nearest police substation, and you have to do 8 hours of community service or a drug education course, and then it's dismissed, no charge ever brought, no record. Now they're doing it with mobile fingerprinting, so they're not even taking them to the police station, and she's looking at expanding it to less than a gram of controlled substances, hard drugs. So one of the things we're dealing with, and I suspect this would be an issue here and in other places, is so let's say she does expand that to less than a gram of, which Texas is a state jail felony, of cocaine or hard drugs. If somebody's got to follow up and make sure that person's doing whatever they're required to, a treatment program, it probably would be a more substantial requirement than the small amount of marijuana. Now, that takes money. Meanwhile, the county's going to be losing money from the state because these people aren't going on probation, because we're funding probation based on how many people are on probation. So that's one of the challenges we're looking at next session, is how can we make sure there's not a fiscal disincentive to do these things by the way we fund corrections. So I would just tell you that, obviously the pretrial issue is a big one, because if you don't bring someone to jail, then they don't have potentially sit there for weeks or months before they can post bail. And during that time, they're not getting any drug treatment. So that's why, to the extent you could divert the people that are appropriate, and again, we're not talking about these high-level drug dealers, but the people that, for small amounts of possession, that in appropriate cases where you can just divert them from ever going to jail to begin with directly into treatment, the police diversion approach, you're actually really making a positive difference for the counties and getting these people immediately into treatment rather than languishing in jail.
Mr. Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, Mr. Levin, thank you for traveling all the way from Texas today to lend us your experience. We tried to give you some decent weather for November. My question is, well, actually, it's a request. You initially described Right on Crime kind of quickly. Could you describe in a little more depth why Right on Crime formed and what your goals are?
Sure.
Well, Mr. Love.
Really, it was kind of an extension on the success in Texas and wanting to share that in other jurisdictions, and a belief that conservatives had historically not necessarily approached this issue in the right way, because those of us on the right, when we looked at other parts of government, education, healthcare, we would be skeptical and say we're not getting good results. But when it came to corrections, historically the thought was, well, let's just spend whatever it takes and lock them up and throw away the keys and all of those kinds of things. And by the same token, we also felt that personal responsibility was important, and we didn't kind of like some of the rhetoric that society causes crime and those things, that people should be given a free pass, so to speak. And we do acknowledge, obviously, there's a role for incarcerating particularly those we're afraid of, not those we're mad at. And so we kind of felt like there were these two ends of the extreme, and we needed to find a way to hold offenders accountable in a way that's sensible, not too tough on taxpayers, but also hold the criminal justice system accountable, not just write a blank check. So that's really where it came about. And so we just started reaching out to various conservative leaders and saying, would you be able to join us in the statement of principles that's outlined on our website, where we basically go through this philosophy. And there's a real emphasis on things like restitution for victims, performance measures for the criminal justice system. I think the medical analogy is a good one, because if you looked at a doctor who was giving someone a course of treatment without doing a thorough assessment, without looking at whether that had worked for people with a similar profile, for example, we would probably say it's malpractice. Now, the criminal justice system is improving in this regard, using actuarial risk and needs assessments, and we're getting better performance measures in a number of jurisdictions. But I still think, compared to, if you look at kind of accountability and focus on outcomes, and whether it's medical treatment or even education, I would say those systems are substantially ahead of where we are in criminal justice. So I think there's ultimately, I guess it boils down to, if the focus was getting even with people rather than getting results, then you're not end up being that concerned with what your results are. But if you're more focused on kind of reducing crime and how can we get the most bang for the buck, then you're going to be wanting to know, is what we're doing working? And so that's kind of where we came to it.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Director Levin, for being here. My question is something that we really haven't talked about yet at this task force, and I'm curious what's happening in Texas. We're looking at our adult prison population, and I don't know what the statistics are, but I'm guessing it's somewhere around 90-95% of adults in correctional system started with some type of engagement with the juvenile justice system. And I'm wondering if Right on Crime is doing anything in looking at doing things differently in Texas relative to juvenile justice system, to actually try to divert those individuals even away from possibly having offenses as they become adults.
Yeah, that's a great question. And by the way, there's an interesting study, I need to forward it to you, but it was an interview where they actually interviewed folks in the adult system who had been in juvenile prisons in the juvenile system, and asked what could the juvenile system have done differently, so you would have gotten on the right track. But I think one of the other things that's interesting is Governor Malloy in Connecticut, who I was on a trip with to Germany to visit prisons there, recently announced wanting to provide an opportunity for those 18 into the early 20s to go into the juvenile system, which would obviously be quite a transformation. And that was consistent with what we found in Germany, where those 18 to 24 can be sentenced and usually are in the juvenile system. And, you know, we were cautioned not to, you know, you can't take everything in Europe and fly it into the United States, and I think our juvenile system isn't prepared for those type of older offenders in many instances. But I think what you can do, for example, is specialized caseloads in the adult system, which we do have in Travis County, which is Austin, Texas. So you've got an 18 or 19-year-old who, frankly, in many places is still in high school. I don't know what your law is in here, but in Texas, you can continue into your early 20s if you haven't gotten your high school degree voluntarily, of course. But if you're 18 or 19, often still in high school, then the juvenile system is, you know, accustomed to working with the school, working with the family, for those still living in the home especially. And you can have specially trained adult officers who have a caseload of 18 to 20-year-olds, or 18 to 21, whatever you want to say, who would be really better set up to work with that population. And, you know, obviously there's, I think, a range of considerations. I mean, I think someone who's 18 and when it's their first offense and hasn't committed crimes before is a particularly appropriate case for something different than the standard adult treatment. And I also think that from an actuarial perspective, when you look at it, regardless of what you think about, you know, brain development and all of those issues, from an actuarial perspective, someone who's 18, 19, they have potentially not only 60 years of life in front of them, but 10 to 15 years in prime crime committing years. From an actuarial standpoint, most crimes are committed by men between 17 and, you know, 35 or whatnot. So it makes more sense to spend a little more, you know, smaller caseload, better training, more treatment for the 18 to 21, 18 to 24, however you want to categorize that. And again, I'm not sure that the juvenile system is set up to take care of that, but the adult system certainly can have specialized caseloads and processes. I think one thing you can look at, though, is in Texas and most other states, the juvenile system has been shrinking so much that, I mean, what happens in our state, again, I don't know your budget process, but the Legislative Budget Board projects how many juveniles are going to be on probation during the next fiscal year, and that number has kept going down. So the result of that is they keep getting their funding cut in the budget. And so, you know, they look at it the other way and say, maybe we do have the bandwidth. In Texas, 17-year-olds are automatically in the adult system. We're one of eight states like that, so we're trying to change that. So our message to them is, look, you're complaining about your budgets being cut. You could actually easily take on these 17-year-olds. And, you know, 17 and 18 is kind of a thin line. A lot of seniors in high school are 18. So giving judges some discretion on this isn't necessarily a bad thing.
All right. Representative Schoen.
My question was answered. Thank you.
Right. Representative Considine.
Considine,
I'm sorry.
Thank you. Why stop at 17, 18? Wouldn't we get more bang for our buck, so to speak, if we had programs that intervened with youth that are high risk, say 13, 14, a commitment to youth intervention programs?
Well, yeah, I mean, you can look at a whole host of things, certainly. I think, you know, I was talking to someone about the school length of the school day, how we arrived at the deal where the school day ends at 2:30 or 3 or whatever it ends, and then you've got a couple hours where those kids aren't supervised by their parents. So there's, you know, these things, you know, may have made sense many decades ago, may not make sense now. But certainly looking at if you look at all these risk assessments, a number of them have first age of conviction. The younger you were when you first got involved in the juvenile and the justice system, the more likely you are to be a higher risk as your life goes on of further offending. I think One of the things is also looking at the school response, because in Texas we had to pass laws to say you can no longer give kids criminal misdemeanor tickets for chewing gum in class. And again, you probably don't have these things here. But in general, schools, what we found is not only were they overusing officers for minor disciplinary things, zero tolerance policies. If a kid had a beer can in his car within 300 feet of the high school, he's automatically suspended or expelled. And of course, again, a lot of this going back decades ago, if a kid was put in out of school suspension, you'd have mom wasn't working, so she'd be at home, make sure he's doing his work. And now, you know, they're in out of school suspension, they're hanging out at a convenience store, getting involved in gangs and things. And we actually found in Texas, if they were in out of school suspension, they were 32 times more likely to be arrested on those days. And literally, it's a big problem. So, I mean, we have some strange laws. I know in Texas, one of the things we're trying to change is if one of the penalties for truancy is out of school suspension. So if you can't come to school, you can't come to school. But again, I'm sure you're much smarter here. But but I would encourage you to look at all these zero tolerance laws and really focus on discipline in the school, through school service, staying after school to clean up, to be in juvenile detention in the school, restorative justice, peer mediation, a whole range of things in the school that can be more effective. And also behavior contracts with parents. There's another thing that some of the charter schools are doing, as well as student behavior accounts, where they can get like little things that, like you'd get an arcade, little prizes like that, but you get money deducted from your account if you've got infractions and things. So there's a lot of innovative things some schools are doing to try to avoid just passing, we call it the passing of the paddle to the justice system. So,
Mr. Chair, I think he answered my follow-up question in there, but you're right, Senator, he does talk fast. So you agree then that the earlier the intervention, the more likely it is to be successful. And that's where you would get your best bang for the buck, if we could identify through youth intervention programs probably the best results.
Yeah, and especially identify kids that have been exposed to violence inside their home or in their neighborhood, because that's a huge predictor of subsequent violence and criminal activity. And there are some programs, some curricula to help them with how they can resolve, you know, disputes with other kids and things in a peaceful way, I think, and just deal with the trauma that they've been exposed to. And I personally believe, well, being in Minnesota, I guess I'll say this, but I mean, you look at, I think Adrian Peterson said he didn't beat his child as hard as his dad beat him. And so there was an example right there of you know, it doesn't matter how much money you have, if you've been exposed to trauma and violence and things, you're going to be at greater risk to do that. It doesn't excuse it. But the earlier you could intervene with something like that, the better. So I'm hoping maybe the NFL will pay for some of those things in our school.
Professor Levy-Pong.
I was going to say, what's refreshing about your presentation for the most part is that you're talking about taking a holistic approach within our system. And yes, we do have significant issues dealing with our school-to-prison pipeline and kids being criminalized too soon for getting into the system. But one of the things that I want to circle back to that you touched upon has to do with mental health aspects. So you talked about it in terms of co-occurring disorders between mental health and drug-related issues. Do you see promising developments in terms of being able to address mental health amongst incarcerated persons from a more holistic perspective? Because I'm guessing here at least 50% of folks who are incarcerated have some type of underlying mental health issue, and we haven't paid enough attention to that.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question, and I think in Minnesota and some of the other states with similar demographics in the northern part of the country, what you tend to find is the mental health, mental illness percent numbers are higher, and the alcohol, the DWI, is higher. If you come down to Texas in the summer, you won't, in the winter, excuse me, you won't feel like you probably need to drink as much as you can be outside. But I'll tell you that on a serious level, the problem is the prison setting isn't the best setting to deliver treatment, but obviously in some instances that's what's required. Obviously, if you've got somebody who's mentally ill but they've committed a very serious violent offense, unless they're going to be in a civil mental health institution, which we've obviously phased out as a country for some good reasons, but I think that led to an overuse of incarceration. But there are people, you know, who commit very serious crimes for mentally ill that do end up appropriately in some type of residential setting, and unfortunately that's generally prison now. So you do need to figure out how you can deliver, obviously, the medications, the counseling, and then, you know, the reentry plan of what are you going to do after they're released. And so I think Minnesota does have a supervised release program, and so I, presuming that they don't have a behavior problem in prison, they would be released onto supervision, and so you can monitor and make sure they're taking medications. For any of the individuals that aren't released on supervised release, that's where we see the biggest problem, because there's no leverage, there's no one to follow up and make sure they're taking their medications. We had this problem in Texas, particularly out of our state jails, because there is no parole with those. So only 18% of them that had their MHMR appointment set up were actually going to the appointment, so they just stopped scheduling them. Whereas people on parole or here supervised release, you okay, that's part of your conditions is to go to that. And you need to have kind of, I think, one of the other problems, and again, you might want to look at this here, is that making sure the county jails, when somebody is picked up and sent to prison, that who was, you know, detained and then sentenced, that their medical records are sent, including whatever medications they're on, because that's been a big problem. Where the prisons don't have access to their prior medical records, and so you're not able to have the continuity of care in the correction system that one would hope for.
Yeah, we did have a budget request, I think, in the last cycle to provide funding to put medical records in electronic format to facilitate that kind of process. We'll see if we can find a way to get that fully taken care of. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Levin, thank you for coming. You've expressed a pretty extensive list of examples for us for youth intervention. I appreciate your doing that and bringing up the ideas of the effectiveness of these youth intervention and prevention programs. We did nicely fund some of the programs last year. I'm hoping that we will continue to do that. They do make a big difference, and long-term, it's an investment in addressing this population problem. We have many things to do, more that we can do with youth intervention, but the prevention and intervention programs do work and will help us with this prison population. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Levin? Judge Small.
Thank you. You do talk. Has Texas, or would you be able to share with us what, if any, criteria Texas uses to distinguish those drug offenders that are, you know, perhaps motivated by addiction from those serious drug offenders that are perhaps motivated by greed or involve violence? What criteria does Texas use to distinguish those two?
Yeah, there's nothing in statute. I mean, in fact, you know, Texas is a state, like most in the South, that doesn't have sentencing guidelines. So it is, you know, so for example, third-degree felony, which is 1 to 4 grams of drugs in Texas, you can get 2 to 10 years, which could be prison or probation. And there are no guidelines or presumptions on sentences. Certainly you can... in federal law, there are certain things, and including in some of the bills that are being discussed now, of saying, was somebody a leader of a large criminal enterprise? Was somebody, you know, an organized crime figure directing? Large criminal enterprise. So you can you could imagine certainly having some gradations so that, yes, it's the same quantity that person had. And part of this gets into the whole conspiracy thing. So if somebody's a director or whatever, they may have had a relatively small amount, but they may be supervising people that taken together had huge amounts. And I think that's what a lot of the federal prosecutions, at least ideally, were intended to focus on. Unfortunately, a lot of the street corner drug dealers have gotten caught up in the federal system as well with long sentences. So when we actually looked at the numbers in the federal system, only about 10% were supervisors, managers, you know, the true kingpins. Yeah, I would say not only look at existing federal law, but some of the actual bills, the Senate bill, which Senator Grassley put together with a bipartisan group in the Senate. If you look in that bill, this has been argued over for months, so there's this very detailed language distinguishing who's a kingpin and who's, you know, selling for personal support of personal habit and those sorts of things. So while Texas isn't, you know, we just rely on the judicial discretion, and frankly, it's more the prosecutorial discretion because most cases, and I'm sure it's the case here as well, are plead out. So, and you know, I think more often than not, they get it right, but we have some of the same issues you do in terms of disparities across counties. You know, in East Texas, sentences are a lot longer than they are in the Rio Grande Valley, for example, and you know, you saw some of those disparities here, and you know, it gives rise to things like we had a guy who was revoked to prison for life for a small amount of marijuana when he was on parole. I mean, Governor Perry ended up commuting that. But, yeah, I think that certainly the problem is that the amount doesn't tell you everything about what actually is going on and what that person's really responsible for or not responsible for. So, and I think one of the issues here is also that the intent is you know, assumed based on a certain amount that they're, you know, a major drug dealer, which, you know, they may be a significant drug dealer or they may mainly just be dealing drugs to their family and friends and supporting their own habit. And, you know, it's sometimes these lines are hard to draw. But the federal system, I think, has attempted to do that anyway.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. More opportunity to hear Mr. Levin 4 o'clock this afternoon at the St. Paul Hotel. There's a gathering there on criminal justice policy. So thank you very much for coming to Minnesota to share your insight and knowledge with us.
Well, thank you.
Appreciate that. All right, we're now going to we're going to turn to Senate File 773. But while that's being set up, I want to say two things. One is we should anticipate going beyond noon. We've had a lot of good information and questions, and I didn't want to cut any of that short because the task force here is inquisitive about these things, which is good. But we do have certain things we want to get done today. Before we turn to the Senate File 773 proposal from Senator Hall, who is unfortunately out of town today, but others have been working on it, will make some presentation. I want to give Josh Esme from the Council on Crime and Justice an opportunity to make some remarks about the health impact assessment that they're working on relating to drug sentencing proposals.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'll be very brief, but I do just sort of want to take a minute to talk a little bit about some of the research that we're doing at the Council on Crime and Justice and perhaps plant a seed for, you know, yet another way that we can sort of think about the effectiveness of the policies that we're discussing. And I sort of echo the other comments. I was also encouraged that the conversation here has started to turn to a sort of a more holistic approach in developing the interventions that these policies implicate. But I think we can even take that a step further and develop a more holistic approach for how we measure the effectiveness of these interventions. And I think we've talked a lot about reducing recidivism as the way we measure whether or not these policies are effective or not. And I think we've seen some good evidence here today that we might be able to make changes in reducing our prison population while still maintaining or even improving those recidivism rates. But I think it's also important to keep in mind that these systems are interconnected to the rest of our community too. And so what we do with the prison system has ripple effects, and one of those is in the area of public health. So the Council on Crime and Justice, along with community partners Nexus and Better Futures, have been working on this health impact assessment. And the goal of it is to evaluate and then educate the public on what the health implications of making some of the policy reforms that we're talking about today would be. I would note that the study defines health broadly, so we're talking both, you know, mental health, so things like depression, anxiety, trauma, but also physical health, cardiovascular health, diabetes, morbidity, and also community health, which would include public safety, aspects related to recidivism, community drug use, gang, and drug-related violence. And the process that our researchers are going through is an in-depth review of the scientific literature, government reports, and then a broad range of interviews with community stakeholders, including criminal justice personnel, but also health workers, mental health workers, addiction service providers. And the goal is to come up with recommendations to the legislature as to how we can maximize the health benefits of drug sentencing reform and also reduce the unintended collateral impacts and health consequences. And we'll have a report that will disseminate to the public and will be available to the legislature as well in early February.
Thank you, Josh. All right, Mark Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the task force. My name is Mark Hazzi, and as you know, I'm a member of the task force. I also represent the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, MACDL, here at the Capitol, and I'm a steering committee member of the Minnesota Second Chance Coalition, which also supports the bill that I'm talking about today. Senator Hall asked me to help with testimony on the bill. I want to thank Senator Hall, as well as co-authors Senators Champion, Peterson, Brandon Peterson, and Senator Goodwin for authoring Senate File 773. The companion bill is House File 994, and Representative Hertas is the chief author on that bill, along with Representatives Dean, Neuberger, Considine.
Let me correct you on this. Dine.
Dine. Thank you. also, Representative Newton, Representatives Newton, Kahn, and Ward. First, I just want to say that the intent of this bill and my discussions with the authors, particularly Senator Hall, and Representative Hertas, is really to have a point for starting the conversation. Sometimes I think policymakers, maybe rightly so, are hesitant to put something in writing and present it to the public. And I think sometimes it takes a little courage and definitely some leadership to be willing to do that. And I want to thank Senator Hall and Representative Hertas in particular for doing that on this bill. That being said, they really intended as a starting point for a conversation rather than necessarily the end product. Just a little bit of review here generally, and I'm going to try to just go through what the bill does fairly quickly and then turn it over to a couple of folks that I'll introduce when I'm done that have much more experience in this than I do and all their experience really on how this plays out in the real world. So in 1989, when the legislature made some of these significant changes to our drug sentencing policies you've heard about, the Minnesota imprisonment rate per 100,000 citizens was 68. Now it's about 176. That's a 250% rate increase. And as you've heard, a large proportion of the increase did come from drug offenders. As you also heard, from 1998 to 2005 alone, the number of Minnesotans in prison for drug offenses tripled to over 2,100. To put that number in a little perspective, 2,100 is more than the state's entire prison population in 1981. Also, between 1990 and 2009, the average time served by a drug offender in Minnesota doubled from 1.1 years to 2.2 years. So again, the authors, as they learned about these changes, they wanted to ask the legislature to think about whether or not this is the best use of taxpayer money and whether or not this is the most effective way to help people escape drug addiction and end its cycle of crime and the impact on its victims. Now that we're faced with the prospect of putting more money into our prison capacity, this discussion is even more important and timely. So the bill proposes five areas of reform for the legislature to consider. We'll spend just a little bit of time on each one. The first proposal is to eliminate mandatory minimum drug sentences. So you've heard about this quite a bit. I wanted to clarify how those work here in Minnesota. Currently, if a conviction is a subsequent controlled substance conviction, and the prior conviction could be at any level, even a state adjudication on a 15218, on the lowest level, then for the second conviction, the mandatory sentence is 4 years for first degree on the current conviction, 3 years for second degree, 2 years for third degree, 1 year for fourth degree, and 6 months for fifth degree. Again, it doesn't matter what the amount was for the previous offense. For example, under current law, if someone is convicted of a fifth degree drug possession, which could be just a trace amount, and it could even be on a state sentence, then they sell or intend to sell 3 grams
or possess 6 grams, which is a second-degree offense, the judge is required to sentence them to 3 years in prison. As you may remember from previous presentations, these are what are called hard mandatory minimums, with no provision for departing. Now, nonetheless, as you've Mr. Reitz's handout today answering some questions covers this, there's still a 21% departure rate in these hard mandatory minimum sentences. And in those 21% where there's a departure, 66% are agreed to by the prosecutor. So for this to happen, some judges must really disagree with these mandatory minimums. I mean, they're essentially willing to stick their neck out politically, possibly, they face elections to ignore what the legislature has said and to create a different sentence, and 66% of the prosecutors agree. Now, however, in the other 79% of these mandatory minimum cases, they are giving the mandatory sentences. And what these sentences, these mandatory minimum statutes do is they prevent judges from tailoring a sentence to the circumstances of the case before them. So this bill contemplates eliminating these mandatory minimums for subsequent controlled substance convictions. Now, remember, judges will still be able to sentence based on criminal history, aggravating and mitigating circumstances, and the sentencing guidelines. I think Mr. Levin mentioned this. According to a Vera Institute of Justice report, 29 states have taken steps to roll back mandatory minimums since 2001. Well, I forgot to mention also, you do have a handout about the bill, a quick summary in your packet, and I've listed information that we've received previously from the sentencing guidelines about the prison bed savings for each part of the bill. For the mandatory minimum elimination, it lists 33 beds. I've talked to Mr. Wright since then, and actually that 33 bed savings is only for the elimination of the third degree. When it comes to first and second degree, it gets really complicated trying to determine those bed savings in relation to the changes in the threshold levels in the bill. So potentially there could be a lot more bed savings for eliminating the mandatory minimums at the first and second degree level that aren't reflected in that 33 bed estimate.
So Mr. Hasse, if we eliminate the mandatory minimum sentence in the statute, the conviction and the sentencing would still be subject to the sentencing guidelines provisions. Is that correct? So they'd have to go with the presumptive sentence unless they find mitigating or aggravating factors and articulate those on the record and so on?
Exactly, Mr. Chair. And again, criminal history, as you know, would be calculated into the sentence and the guidelines as well.
Representative Hilsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hasse, thank you for talking that you included this Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission sheet. I'm actually looking at the chart that you were just talking about, and you say that 33 beds. I just want to make sure I'm reading the graph correctly. So the bill on the left-hand side says House File 2107 and Senate File 773. So is the whole chart for both bills because they're the same, or is the upper portion Senate File 773 and the lower portion House File 2107, or is it both bills are the same and it's the entire chart?
Mr. Chair?
House File 994.
Are you referring to my handout, Representative Hillstrom, or the Sentencing Guidelines Commission's yes. handout?
I'm talking about the Sentencing Guidelines worksheet that, or sheet that you said that you included. And I just, you referenced the 33 beds, so I just want to make sure I'm reading the chart correctly because I have a couple of other questions yeah. about this chart as well.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, actually, what I meant to say is that I'm using that data, but I didn't provide that handout, and Mr. Wrights could answer that question better.
Mr. Reitz, there are two handouts floating around. So Mr. Hasse is referring to the handout that's titled Senate File 773, House File 994, yes, and Representative Hillstrom is referring to Table 3 on my memorandum, the Q&A memorandum. So they both reflect the same information. With respect to the mandatory minimum elimination, it's very we have to make our estimates based on assumptions that we can validate, and it's very difficult to make assumptions regarding what a departure rate will be for a crime in the future. Right now, there is a departure rate of 21% for first and second degree controlled substance crimes. There's a departure from the guidelines and a departure from the statutory mandatory minimum, if you will. The House Senate File 773 would eliminate the mandatory minimum, but there would still have to be a departure from the guidelines for an offender to get probation. So it's very difficult for us to make a valid assumption of how much more judges are going to depart if they are only departing from the guidelines as opposed to departing from the guidelines and the mandatory minimum. So we don't have an estimate for what the bed savings will be for that because we don't know. We can only estimate based on what we know. So the 33 beds is just for the mandatory minimum being eliminated for third-degree controlled substance crimes because there are offenders who are going to prison now because of the mandatory minimums who under the guidelines presumably will not go to prison because the guidelines will presume a stayed sentence. So that's what the 33 beds are for. There's probably, I guess I could say, probably an additional bed savings due to the elimination of the mandatory minimums, but the guidelines presume a longer sentence than the mandatory minimums, so we just don't know what that bed savings will be.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have to leave at noon, so you'll have to bear with me from being a little bit off subject, but I want to look at your other estimates. So the entire chart then estimates the bed savings for each section of the bill, correct? So this is the bill they're presenting. So the top threshold would save 500, it's estimated to save 575 beds. And then the chart that, as the chart continues on, it says 51% of those beds are, that will be saved are from people of that are white, 25% are people of color. Is that how I read this chart? So in essence, of the 575 beds that will be saved, 51% of those will be Caucasian. Is that correct?
Mr. Wright.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilstrom, that's our estimate based on 2014 sentencing data. So all these estimates were based on 2014 sentencing data. Those are the 575 beds that we estimate are going to prison in based on 2014 sentencing data that are not going to go to prison. And then the chart breaks down what the race of those 575 prison bed occupants would look like. So yes, you're exactly correct, Representative Hilstrom.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Professor Levy Pounce.
I like the proposal to eliminate mandatory minimums. Huge national conversation about it, and they're not effective at addressing these issues. But I'm wondering why we're taking for granted that the use of criminal history points in the state of Minnesota is effective. Because there are a number of concerns in terms of what's happening with juveniles who, you know, maybe commit a low-level offense as a kid, and now suddenly they're facing a much longer sentence because of something that they did as an adult. So why isn't this bill addressing that particular issue?
Mr. Hoskins.
Mr. Chair and Professor Levy-Pounds, that's a great point. It's a very valid, important concern, and I think, as you know, criminal history score by some research has shown to be a major contributing factor to racial disparities in our criminal justice system. Not having it in this bill was just a decision that the authors made to, you know, sometimes you have to pick your battles, and, you know, it took a fairly, it just decided, it was just not done, no particular reason, I guess, is my answer. It was the bill itself focused on these provisions. But I think it's something that we should consider also.
Go ahead. Continue your presentation.
Okay. And one last comment on the mandatory minimums. This is actually referring to going back to Representative Cornish's question about what the Sentencing Guidelines Commission can or can't do. The Sentencing Guidelines Commission cannot revise the mandatory minimum sentences. So if this were to be changed, the legislature would have to do it. The next part of the bill is to raise the drug crime threshold weights to make sentences more proportionate to the offense and level of culpability. You just heard at least one long presentation about how things worked in Minnesota in 1989, and rather than going through any of that again, I'm just going to tell you that this bill's intent is to take our sentences for first, second, and third degree drugs back to 1989. Again, as a conversation starter, you know, based on what you heard, there definitely may be some merit to how those sentences, that we think that there's merit to how those sentences worked back in 1989, and that's essentially what this bill does. I will just make a quick note. There was an error in drafting the bill or an omission. We neglected to eliminate possession with intent to sell from the definition of sale. In 1989, as you already heard, intent to sell was presumed in the possession amounts, and it was our intent to use the exact same structure. So this bill as written does not reflect that intent, and so still does not adequately distinguish between high, mid, and low levels of the distribution change. So if the legislature did want to use the 1980 model, that omission would have to be corrected. And again, on the handout,
Mark, I'm going to interrupt you.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quick question. You say it's going back to 1989. Is it going back to where crack is less than powdered cocaine?
No, it's, Mr. Chair and Representative Considine, it's going back to post-Russell.
Pre-Russell.
I'm sorry, pre-Russell. And pre, it's treated.
Will crack and powdered cocaine be treated the same?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. And then on the handout in the back, as was already pointed out, there are the Sentencing Guidelines Commission's estimates of bed savings for each of the levels of controlled substance threshold changes for a total of 575 bed savings. The next part of the bill, again, this is something that would be only in the legislature's purview, would make current drug possession stay of adjudication law presumptive rather than permissive. Currently, as you've heard, Minnesota Statute 15218 permits one-time deferred prosecution with eventual dismissal and no conviction if probation is successfully completed for certain low-level drug offenders. Some judges, I've heard that it varies quite a bit by county, some judges use it as a matter of course, and some do not. Senate File 7-73 would require this deferred prosecution. The requirements for eligibility would remain unchanged. It would apply to possession, not sale, fourth and fifth degree only. No prior drug convictions would be allowed, and as well as no prior dispositions under Section 15218. Making this disposition presumptive rather than permissive will create more fairness in its application between judges and between counties, and as you know, save 103 prison beds according to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. And it'll save using those beds for the very lowest level drug offenders. Now, this is not in the bill, but I want to throw this out there, and Mr. Levin mentioned this. An alternative to this bill to get at this issue of the lowest level offenders would be to make those offenses misdemeanors or gross misdemeanors. In addition to the District of Columbia and federal law, there are 15 states that treat drug possession as a misdemeanor. According to data collected by the Drug Policy Alliance, which I included in my remarks here, but I didn't have a chance to include a copy in the materials, I'd be happy to do that. Treatment admission rates are higher in states with misdemeanor penalties for drug possession, and crime rates are actually slightly lower in misdemeanor states.
Hmm.
Making drug possession a misdemeanor could also have additional state prison bed savings that are not mentioned in the fiscal note here. Currently, if someone violates the conditions of probation on a felony deferred sentence, they may be sent to prison. And we just heard from Commissioner Roy, I didn't know prior to this what the number was. According to Commissioner Roy, there's 525 beds being filled by these lowest level offenders who got a felony stay of adjudication, and for whatever reason that may need to be looked at, they were sent to prison.
Excuse me, Representative
yes.
Mr. Hossie, Representative Johnson has a question.
Dealing with that aspect of lowering it to misdemeanors or gross misdemeanors, do you have any idea what that cost would be to the counties? And it'd be savings to the state, but we'd be pushing that cost off to the counties and not funding that. And with the treatment that you talk about, again, that would be pushed on to the counties and taken away from the state, so the state would save money, but it'd be putting on the backs of the taxpayers mm-hmm. that pay property taxes.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
Johnson, I think Mr. Levin made a really good point about the importance of making sure these individuals still get treatment, because if we don't treat them, they're going to come back in the system. I agree if we're pushing that down to the county, we should figure out how to provide the funding for that for the counties. And the last part of this bill, I'll just jump to, talks about reinvestment, which many other states have done when they've seen savings in reducing the prison population. They've reinvested that money in treatment programs and, could go to this bill talks about treatment, victims programs, and I think one other type of program, but it could go to all those county probation and treatment options to help offset that.
Mr. House.
Oh, one thing, if the idea of moving the simple possession down to misdemeanor or gross misdemeanor is done, one thing to consider is that an important part of the opportunity with a stay of adjudication on a felony is that that person then can legally say if they complete probation they've never been convicted of a crime. If we just make it a gross misdemeanor or misdemeanor and now they have a conviction on their record, that could have unintended collateral consequences. So the legislature may also want to look at how there could even be a deferred conviction on the gross misdemeanor or misdemeanor for a for the simple possession offense. Really quick here, another part of the bill expands eligibility for early conditional release of nonviolent substance abuse offenders. It deals with a current statute that allows some offenders to be released early if they had already completed half of their sentence or 36 months, completed treatment, and weren't convicted of a violent crime within 10 years. Information I've received from the Department of Corrections is that about 10 offenders have been released under this program. I think that's in the per year recently. That seems to be a very small amount. Senate File 773 would allow people convicted of drug crimes to be included, not just possessors, even low-level sale crimes. It would kick in no later than 18 months into the sentence rather than 36, and cover those who weren't convicted of a violent crime within 5 years. Those are sort of arbitrary numbers, but the point is we should be looking at ways to, especially in the drug offenses, get people out of prison a little earlier if it's appropriate and they don't otherwise pose a risk. And the savings on the prison beds is not in the fiscal note the bed savings note that the Guidelines Commissions did, so we don't know what those savings would be at this point. And then finally, as I already mentioned, the last part of the bill requires that the savings from these changes would be reinvested, as the bill states it, in substance abuse and mental health treatment programs, offender educational programs, and crime victim services. And the total bed savings in a number of years for this bill would be 727, but as you heard, there's a number of areas where the savings could be greater than that. That's going to end my testimony in the bill. I'm going to introduce the other testifiers. If anybody has any questions particular to me, I could.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead?
All right. I'm pleased to introduce a couple people, as I said, who have a lot more experience in this area. Brock Hunter is a criminal defense attorney who handles all types of cases in the state and federal courts. He served as the president and legislative chair of the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. In that role, he's been involved in various efforts and formal conversations in the past regarding Minnesota's controlled substance sentencing laws. He's happy to be back doing it again. He's also a former U.S. Army recon scout who focuses his practice on defending psychologically injured veterans in the criminal courts and advocating for reforms in the way the justice system deals with them, and is well known locally and nationally as an expert and advocate on that issue. He's also co-written a book on the subject and started an organization to support veterans in criminal justice policy reforms. And I'll just let the second testifier go right after him. That's Gina Evans, who's the outreach director at Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge. Adult and Teen Challenge's mission is to assist teens and adults in gaining freedom from chemical addictions and other life-controlling problems by addressing their physical, emotional, and spiritual needs. They have programs throughout Minnesota with campuses in Minneapolis, Brainerd, Duluth, Rochester, and Buffalo. Ms. Evans is also has a lot of experience with the criminal justice system, quite a bit of it in her youth when she was struggling with her own addictions. She was at the receiving end of the system, and for a number of years since then is in her work at Adult and Teen Challenge. She has worked with many, many people and their families who are impacted by the system. Thank you. That was strong.
Thank you.
Mr. Hunter.
Mr. Chair, as Mark indicated, I have spent a lot of time working on drug sentencing reform as the legislative chair for MACDL, and it's an issue near and dear to my heart, and I'm really encouraged by the conversation I'm hearing here today. It seems like things are finally starting to come around, and I'm very hopeful. We spent a lot of time talking about the financial impacts of prison sentencing with respect to drugs, and I wanted to spend just a little bit of time talking about some of the intangible costs of imprisoning nonviolent drug offenders, both on the offenders themselves as well as on society. In my practice of nearly 20 years, mostly criminal defense, I have, despite my best efforts, seen many, many of my clients go off to prison for drug offenses. And I've seen them come back. And though a few come back rehabilitated and assets to their communities rather than liabilities, more often than not, they come back worse off from their time in prison. They struggle to reintegrate into their communities. They are institutionalized by their time in prison. And they struggle with the stigma that a society attaches to lengthy prison sentences. Felony convictions make it hard enough to find a job or get proper housing, but if you spend a lengthy stint in prison, it's exponentially more difficult. You've just got the taint of prison on you, and it's really hard to put it behind. And many of these folks, unfortunately, because of the lack of alternatives, end up back in criminal offenses and back on my doorstep, and we're doing the whole process all over again. In my work in this area, I spent a lot of time reading about institutionalization and reading work from a sociologist named Irving Goffman, who popularized the notion of the total institution back in the 50s and 60s, and other folks have written extensively about it since then. Basically, a total institution is any situation where a large number of similarly situated people are cut off from wider community for a considerable amount of time, enclosed and leading a highly controlled life. And Goffman describes these institutions ranging from monasteries and convents to the military to nursing homes, mental hospitals, and especially prisons. And prisons are a particularly extreme form of the total institution. These are alternate realities where there's a different set of values, a different set of rules, very different from our normal society. The longer a person spends in these environments, the harder it is for them to reintegrate back into our communities. Just as simple as that. Prisons are a total institution where the culture of the institution is controlled not just by the people who run the prisons, but also by the prisoners themselves, and it's often the most hardened of the criminals in prison who control and dominate the culture. And when you have nonviolent offenders coming into this culture, it's particularly concerning because they have to adapt to this environment to survive. In some cases, they have to join a prison gang in order to survive. You've heard probably the term of getting a master's degree in crime in prison, and I've seen that happen on a personal level with many of my clients. You also see people who go off to prison are victimized and traumatized by their prison experience, either assaulted or sexually assaulted, or even just the threat of that happening to them can have a huge emotional, psychological impact on them that follows them when they get out and return back into the community. This is a vicious cycle, and I think we have to recognize that when we send people off to prison, we often have them come back worse off, creating more problems than they would have otherwise if they had gotten treatment and had been allowed to stay in their communities. And we also see instances in which these people have been removed and they leave behind families who are now without parents. Particularly in the African American community in the last 20 years, we've seen huge numbers of parents removed from the community and sent off to prison for long periods of time, leaving their kids to fend for themselves on the streets, where the whole cycle just perpetuates itself all over again.
Mr. Hunter, we have a question for you. Representative yes. Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How would you respond to critics who say that all of the horrible consequences that happen in prison are a deterrent to behavior?
Mr. Hunter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertas, I think in some cases it probably is a deterrent, but I think in so many other cases these people come out, again, institutionalized, traumatized, with very limited options to reintegrate back into their community, and whatever deterrent value is there is outweighed by those factors, and they end up falling right back into the same patterns and re-victimizing the communities that we're trying to protect. The retribution model has its sort of visceral appeal, but I think in reality we end up creating more problems if we're thinking along those realms, and deterrence as well. And as Mr. Hazy is just whispering in my ear, we've also got addiction issues here, and if those go unaddressed, the deterrent value is often outweighed by the addiction and going back into that use. The bottom line is we need prisons to protect us from the worst and most dangerous in our society. We need to house those people away from our community. But I think we need to think long and hard about who we send off there, because often we get back people who are more dangerous to our communities than those we send. And that's all I've got. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Evans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the task force. As Mark said, my name is Gina Evans, and I serve as the Community Outreach Director at Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge. I've been in that position for almost 10 years. I was going to get on my soapbox about mandatory minimum legislation because I've had that conversation with many of you at the table, but I'm going to let that go because I feel like my experience before I got sober is probably a little more valuable to this group than the mandatory minimum stuff. And so I started using drugs intravenously at 15 years old. I was part of the juvenile justice system. When I was 19, I got caught with 1/10 of a gram of meth in my purse and received my first felony conviction. I have 12 felony convictions. 4 of them are drug related. Of those 4 felony convictions, 2 of them were fifth degree for trace amounts. One of them was 1/10 of a gram, and the other one was a syringe with Representative Hillstrom talked about dosages with one dose in it where they charged me with a fourth degree. I ended up doing 15 months on that charge. And granted, probation and all of that stuff was part of my sentencing, but I couldn't get sober no matter how hard I tried. I had children and a family that loved me, and I couldn't get it together. And 30 days in treatment, I've been to prison 3 different times, and of those 3 times that I spent at Shakopee Women's Prison, I was never there long enough to receive treatment services because my sentences were so short. My daughter learned how to read in a prison visiting room. That's something that I'm super not proud of, but it's a reality for my family. And the thing for me is that my family was in a position to be able to care for my children. There are lots, thousands of families who aren't in a position, so those kids end up in foster care or in really safe, unsafe places. I've been through treatment 3 different times other than the time that I spent at Teen Challenge, and you know, it was 30 days of treatment, and then you're back out into the community. And I'm not advocating for length of treatment here by any stretch of the imagination. But I just am here to really let you guys know that the prison system for low-level drug offenders oftentimes does turn into this revolving door in and out of the system with very few resources within that system. I heard that one of the options that they're talking about for more bed space is back to Appleton. And when you look at the 300-mile trip both ways, and I know there's some statistics that talk about recidivism rates for people who get visits while they're in prison and people that don't get visits while they're in prison, and I just really don't feel like that's a viable option for these low-level offenders that we're talking about here. And then I found this in my purse. This is a gram. The sugar that's in here is 1 gram, the very bottom of this. And Representative Hillstrom talked about doses. Depending on the potency of something like this, it's like 2 doses or maybe 3 doses. And so, and just a little math lesson for everyone, if you buy just this gram on the street, it costs about $90. If you buy an 8-ball, which is 3.5 grams, it costs about $200. If you buy 7 grams, it's about $350. And so if I'm a drug addict, I never was a drug dealer. I never, ever was a drug dealer. But there were times when I had 7 grams of drugs in my pocket, and I just shared it with people who had money. You can call it selling if you want, but so that my drugs were cheaper. I'm telling you guys, 7 grams is not a lot. That's not a drug dealer. That's somebody with a drug addiction. And we need to, as a state, stop throwing away people with drug addiction and get them the help that they need. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Evans, for sharing your story. Are there any questions from Ms. Evans? Mr. Mata.
Mr. Chair, one thing I just want to say when we talk about this is we talk about low-level or fifth degrees or first degrees, I really think there's a way we have to try to interject low-risk offenders and high-risk offenders instead of focusing too much on a fifth degree or fourth degree or third degree. It makes it hard to really do the job to make sentencing recommendations because we may look at somebody, we're doing a pre-sentence investigation on this, a second-degree controlled substance offender. It could be completely different recommendations, but we should be doing that based on the risk and the need of these individuals. Are they amenable to supervision? Do they need treatment? Do they need chemical dependency treatment? It makes it tough. It gets us crossways even sometimes with our county attorneys when they say, you have to be consistent. Well, we are based on risk and need, but not necessarily by the guidelines. So I don't have a specific proposal, but I think when we talk about how we're doing sentencing, we have to look not just at the offense of high and low offenses, whether it's fifth or fourth degree, but the level of the risk and the needs of the individuals that we're serving out there.
Anyone else? Questions or comments?
Mr. Chair, even as I'm sitting here, we're dealing with how do we treat people in jail, questions that are coming up as we're sitting here, and the lack of resources that we have to deal with the addiction. So it's a real-time problem. I just want to say we've worked with Gina for many years, a true person that is really out there. We tried an experiment. We brought Teen Challenge and their group of about 50 or 60 people together with over 100 law enforcement officers. I think it was one of the best exchanges that we ever had. It was very interesting because we had people there that we put in prison and put in jail. It was a good exchange for all both sides. And I really think that it's a way that we have to work. We have to find some compromises along the way. A lot of steps in between. But again, back to the whole resource issue, we just do not have the resources of intervention for chemical dependency and mental illness in our facilities that we're dealing with, and it's a critical issue.
Commissioner Roy.
Chair, Mr. Franklin, do you sense that there's an appetite in the sheriff's organization to develop treatment programs in jails?
Mr. Franklin.
That's a somewhat very difficult question. I really think there's an appetite to try to figure out to do something. We have many small counties in which perhaps full-blown treatment programs in small facilities just not are viable. It goes to the discussion of regionalization. It goes to the discussion of how we do probation and how effective we are on that regionalization type of approach. And I think there's no question that I think we would welcome it in some way, because we deal with it every single day as we transition people in and out and through the system multiple times. Our frequent flyers, we know them. It's we can articulate in many times the needs. What we lack is the resource and the accountability for them to be successful, and when they're not successful, the immediate intervention to get them in compliance.
Maybe I should have started that by saying with adequate resources, sheriffs would have an appetite.
I think it's broader than the sheriffs. I mean, we're talking about a holistic approach. We're talking about our social workers. We're talking about treatment professionals. Right now, the system is so fragmented. I've talked to the good senator who has left here about the addiction issues of chemical dependencies, drug, alcohol, and mental, and how we need to take a holistic, comprehensive approach to that. I think it's broader than just the sheriffs. I think it's a comprehensive approach that involves a lot of public elected officials. And frankly, it all involves the entire community of the state of Minnesota. This is not just sheriffs trying to fix it, or you or I, Tom. It is everybody's problem, because every one of us has a family member or a friend who has an issue somewhere.
Representative Cornish.
Well, Sheriff, what do you think about catching them before they come to jail, then? Specialty courts, broadening our specialty courts, DWI and drug courts, and getting before they get to jail, then you don't have to worry about treatment in a jail setting. Right now, the specialty courts, I think, are narrowing the field because they can't afford to take everybody on, plus they're a little bit worried about the hardcore person. They take more of the people that are amenable to treatment, but that definition varies from from court to court. Some people don't want to take on the person that's further into it. And I could ask Josh, too, what you think of that as far as specialty courts handling more of these people before they get to jail, because then you don't have the confinement problem. They're home with the your analysis and the reporting in and the sanctions and the rewards. And so I could ask.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I've definitely been open to expanded use of specialty courts, and we're a county in Blue Earth County where we have a veterans treatment court, we have a hybrid drug DWI court, we have a family dependency court, but I'll really focus on our hybrid drug court DWI court. You know, we typically have around 50 individuals in that drug court at a time and around 1,500 individuals on probation in our county. And so we also look at a court where we're not allowed to have people with crimes of violence. Oftentimes, first and second degree controlled substance offenders are allowed into that court. So we look at a population that isn't always our highest risk and our highest need. And I think that can sometimes, we can look at that across the state of Minnesota, that it isn't always our highest risk and need that are chemically dependent. And whether it goes back to the statements made earlier, whether it's a first or second degree or a fourth or fifth degree, if it's chemical dependency, it's chemical dependency, and we could treat them in that court, especially if it's first-time offenders that are sometimes coming in. It'd really be nice to give them this service instead of 86 months in prison. So definitely really would be supportive of how can we expand that and let more eligibility, because I think it's, and whether it's specialty courts or just other programs like that that really focus on risk and needs, I think it's not the only model, but it's a model that we've seen some success.
I had a client in Hennepin County that had a 15-year-old drug conviction from a different state, and that defined as a crime of violence under Minnesota statute. He was not allowed on a more recent case into the drug court because of that old conviction. And even the judge in charge of the court said he needed to be in that court. It was the right place for him to be, but the rules of that court did not allow him to be accepted into that court.
And just to follow up with that, and I think sometimes we see those old crimes from 15, 20 years ago are also a result of that chemical dependency. That's oftentimes that need that's driving some of those crimes to commit those.
Representative or Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just wanted to state that I'm hearing a lot of good ideas, but I would hope that people would look at the actual fact of decriminalization of the disease of addiction. If someone has enough drugs on them that is not considered for sale, they obviously are using them. They should be going to treatment. They should be getting help. They should not be locked up in a prison or a jail or whatever. We need to expand our community resources. I think putting more of these people in the criminal justice system, as well as, I mean, I like the drug courts, they're working, but is that really where we want to put our resources? And our treatments, I get pretty frustrated. You know, we're known as the land of 10,000 treatment centers, but quite frankly, we don't do a very good job. Most people who go to 28-day treatments are not successful. It's very small percentage, and it's almost like negligible for people with opioid addiction. We need long-term treatment for people who have these addictions. And until we do that, we're going to continue to pay money to lock them up in prisons.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Roy, Mr. Franklin, you talked about treatment programs at the county level. The county I live in, with counties in the and the neighboring counties, have gotten together and doing that treatment in the jails, and it is working. What they're finding is, instead of doing the furloughs, just sending them out to these treatment facilities, keeping them in the jail, participating in the programs in the jail, it's having a much better effect. And it's working because they want to be there. They want to go to the treatment. When they get the furloughs to go to the treatment, generally they do not show up. And then ends up going to a warrant and we bring them back to jail. But by providing the treatment in the jail facility, they're having much better success.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, hi, Gina. Gina and I worked together when I was the counselor and program director at the Blue Earth County Jail. But the reason I was going to raise my hand was to suggest that I believe that drug court diverting them is better than putting them in jail. One of the reasons is because of what Senator Eaton just said, is that most of the time they're in there 18 months, 2 years, where they have supervision, and it's long term, and they keep an eye on them, and at the same time they keep them out of jail. So I think the specialty courts are working, and for low level drug, you know, keep them out of jail, make sure they have supervision. Representative Cornish, one of the things when I was working at Blue Earth County Jail that surprised me, in fact I would have bet against it, was that they did have a lot of success with the old time people. I thought would never change. I thought that primarily the success rate would be among the young kids that were coming in the first time. A lot of them weren't ready to make the decision to change, whereas a lot of the older hardcore people turned out were. And so to be honest, I was really surprised when a lot of the early successes were in the Blue Earth County Court were people that had, that I would qualify as hardcore drug users.
Thank you, Chair Latz and Chair Cornish. It's been productive in having these task force meetings during the interim. And I think you aptly identified the work that's before us and the need that's before us. You know, it would be nice to think that the outcomes would always be predictable and that everybody can be the same, that like a factory you can have an input and expect the same output, and that a widget is a widget, but people are not widgets and people have unique characteristics and unique circumstances. And what we've heard here today, and even in the case of one of the testifiers at the table right now, is that reform and reformation, redemption, forgiveness is possible. And I think the real challenge has been with the guidelines that were established in 89 is that there's going to be this uniform application of fairness to all, regardless of who you are, where you come from, what your circumstances are. That's the penalty. That's not treating people with compassion or treating them humanly. And I know if we start going down this road where we start looking at individual cases, individual circumstances, the interjection of race is going to come into it as though one group is being preferred over another. So that'll be a real challenge as we go forward. But I think that the diversion programs, intervention programs, things for first-time low-level offenders is an absolute necessity, especially if you're a conservative. You don't believe in wasting money. You believe in taking care of the problem, of affecting a different result. Is it going to be successful every time? Probably not. Is it going to make a difference? We would hope so. Can these people be mainstreamed and get back into society, be productive, be mothers, be fathers, be parents, contribute to the community and not be a burden? You know, that's our goal. That's what the name Department of Corrections at least assumes to imply. And so those are my comments. These have been great discussions. I hope we move in that direction.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a couple of comments. You know, we've talked a lot about first-time offenders, and when it comes to addiction, a first-time offender who turns their life around is very rare. So we need to be cognizant that it's an insidious disease, and as was mentioned earlier, that sometimes it rears its ugly head 10, 15, 20 years later. So let's not just talk just about first-time offenders, because quite frankly, sometimes second-time offenders, third-time offenders, and fourth-time offenders are the ones that turn their lives around as well. So it's really important that we think of that in context. And, you know, I'm not a chemical dependency treatment expert. When I tend to speak, I tend to speak from my own experience. And one of the things that happens oftentimes with short-term treatment is individuals go right back to their same environment upon completion. And in my case, and most of the people that I know that have been successful, they don't go back to that same environment. So I think we need to look at our system on what we do with individuals once we let them out the door after they successfully completed their treatment. Because chances are, if they're going back to the same environment they were in prior to their offense or prior to entering chemical dependency treatment, I'd put my money on them starting to use again. So let's try to keep that in the context. It's been a lot of really great discussion. I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, for where we're at, and I'm really looking forward to us sort of moving this ball either down the field or backwards on the field, whichever your perspective is. Thank you.
All right. Any further comments or questions or discussion on any topic that's come before the task force today?
I'm sorry, but yes.
Representative Consonant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just, as one of the authors on the bill, I should have probably made this clearer before I signed on, but I would like it clear that if we're going back to pre-Russell, that we're not going back to a differentiation between crack and powdered cocaine. It just says cocaine on there. I'd like to make sure that that's clear.
All right, so for our next task force meeting will be December 18th, 9 o'clock, right here. The agenda will be determined and announced for all of you. It's been a very interesting and helpful conversation today. Thanks for all your participation. Have a good Thanksgiving. We'll see you next month.